In association with NintendoReport.com, ChildsPlayCharity.org, and listeners just like you, you're listening to the first part of NWR's second annual live telethon. On November 19th, for an unprecedented 9 hours, the site crew and more than a few special guests got together to raise some money for Child's Play, an international nonprofit that gives toys, games, and systems to pediatric wards and hospitals. We actually surpassed our goal and raised nearly $4,000 over the course of the day. In this first part, the RFN crew discusses their new business, Neil, Andy, and Greg talk about Skyward Sword, and finally, we take some time to talk to you, our beloved audience. Now, before we get to the show, it should be noted that this wasn't recorded in the usual fashion, and as a result, there might be some cutting in and out or a few technical snags here and there. That being said, it was a wonderful show, and I'm sure you'll enjoy listening to it just as much as we enjoyed making it. All right, folks, enough from me. Let's get to the show. There are no bad ideas in live radio.
There are plenty of bad ideas in live radio.
I'll hold you to that, Carl. All
right, we are live again.
Again, for the second time.
Okay. This time for
real. Good morning.
Good morning, Cincinnati.
No, all not right. Cincinnati.
I'm sure someone out there is in Cincinnati. Perhaps. All right. Well, the good thing is that I'm recording this. This is going beautifully.
How about we introduce ourselves to our listeners since, you know, we're live.
Sure.
Welcome
well,
to the RFN 2011 live show for the Child's Play Charity.
It's not the podcast, people.
It's not the podcast, people.
It will be the podcast, though, people.
In the future.
Yeah.
So, go ahead, Carl. You organize
okay,
it.
Well, thank you, James. I am not your host, Carl Castaneda, but I am going to be here for about 5 minutes while I'm just the dude that's behind someone else. So don't worry about
hey
it.
Now.
Hey now. So I'll be out of here in about 5 minutes when Johnny gets back and takes the reins for this show. But this is a listener bonus. This probably won't make it into the actual like released version later. I sincerely doubt it anyway.
It's probably a good
we're not editing this thing. What are you talking about?
Oh, I'm gonna edit it. I'm gonna put chapters on this bitch. Like, don't get it wrong.
You are devoted.
Yes. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh, I put chapters on last year. All 6 hours of it got chapters last
year. Wow.
I don't know if we're gonna release it as one chunk. That might not be a good idea. It's one
or
large.
Idea.
Or maybe it's the best idea. I don't know. Maybe our listeners can comment in the chat room and let us know what they want.
Yeah, I mean, if you want a big file, that will probably be, what, 300 megabytes?
8 hours, that's 480 minutes, that's 64 kilobytes, that's about 235 megabytes.
Oh, you're going to do 64 kilobytes? Oh, man.
It's good. What do you want it to be, 128?
The music's going to be, well.
Listen to this pre-planning, people.
All right, hey, welcome to the show, guys.
Welcome
to the show. Thank you, Carl.
Bye, Carl.
In all seriousness, though, Carl's kind of the mastermind who came up with this last year, and so good on him, even though we give him crap.
Thank you. No.
It did help coordinate this year as well, so I shouldn't give him too much crap.
No, it's going to be a great show. Johnny and the gang have a lot of great stuff planned. So once he gets back here, I'll jump off and the fun can begin, as it were. But until then, you were just listening to us stalling.
Until then, you're not allowed to have any fun.
Yeah, we're waiting for Johnny Metz, a.k.a. the straw that stirs the drink. I am John Lynch. your director alumnus.
Dear God, oh, how did Lord. We survive?
Now, I know a way we can fill some time.
Uh-oh.
Lindy, how about some DK rap?
No.
Some DK rap.
How about not?
Listen to Greg. Everybody's requesting DK rap. Yeah, I have to understand.
Everyone
Yeah, I mean the best I could do is would be some rap off the top of the head. I don't have anything prepared. I didn't come with my writtens, so to speak.
Off the dome.
Johnny comes. The ring the bell. Johnny comes just in the nick of time.
Thanks, Johnny.
Johnny, you might not know this, but we're live right now.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah. We already did intros. They weren't good.
I don't think the intros. Yeah,
I mean, they weren't
involved,
even really intro. Like, they were just kind of
say
rambling.
Who we were. I'm TYP. I'll be on for the radio trivia segment.
And I'm Procrastinator. I will be on for hours 7 and 8 if we get there. But we're almost to the show, and these guys have work to do. So I'm going to jump off, let them take the reins, and get this shit started. So
peace out.
See you later, baby. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
If you want to hear more of Carl's voice, get donating.
Mm-hmm. I'm connecting to the...
So, Johnny, why don't you explain what we're donating for since this is the introduction?
Well,
just in case anybody
missed
out.
Are we officially started yet? I've got still got a couple
minutes on my clock. We are broadcasting.
Yeah, I know we're broadcasting, but is the show starting
Well,
yet?
We might as well.
Yeah.
I mean, at least we'll cut into new business time.
I just don't want people to miss the beginning.
I don't think anybody's going to be upset.
If you start early, you leave people out.
If you start late, you leave people too.
Nope. If you start late, everybody catches it.
It's going to be recorded. It's fine.
We got a couple minutes to go. Now everybody settle down.
Yep.
Yeah, we have to get new business in there.
I know.
In an hour.
Yep.
We've never recorded new business in an hour. It's never happened.
We did it last year.
We did it on the N64 show, but that was because it was really short.
That's because I wasn't on there.
Do you understand the physics of what you're asking us to do? We've had three game new businesses go for an hour and a half.
Yes, we have.
Yeah, but they were all Pokemon Mystery Dungeon.
Oh no!
Or various variations thereof.
There's no variations. It's all the same.
But yeah, that's the thing though. Like those really long ones, they always seem to be James Jones going on about a game he really hates, but yet he put about 200 hours into. So
anyway, if you'd like to, if you're listening to the stream, but you're not in the IRC, you can jump in our chat room while we're waiting for the show to start in earnest. And talk with other people listening, and maybe send us some questions. We might see them in the chat room and respond.
Well, our assistant will see them and then feed them to us, right, Carl?
Carl's not here.
Carl's muted, right?
Carl's but
he's
gone.
He's gone. He's dead.
Everybody knows. He knows.
He's in the chat.
He's our assistant.
But so here's the basic starting point being that I don't remember where are we going with this. Oh, that we're going to do new business coming up, so that's
yes,
awesome.
That's where we talk about video games.
New business. But the schedule doesn't say new business. It says new business with a twist or something like that. And I don't know
that I took that off.
Damn it.
Because I don't know what the hell.
Your twist.
It's live. That's the twist. Now, I wasn't sure if we would have a guest for the segment or not, but all our guests are coming later. So you have to pay to hear the guests. You get us for free.
The first hit is free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so it's just the four of us on here right now, isn't it? Or is TYP, are you talking? Are you
I can if you want. Otherwise, I will mute myself.
Okay, well, I don't know what you have for new business.
Go 3D
Mario
lands.
Bros, man.
Well, hey, stay on the line. Shit.
You have more new biz than me, man. So
yeah. You're just here for the character, John.
Yep.
John's
just
here. Look,
I'm just a color commentary.
You are the John Madden of this broadcast.
Bam!
I was thinking more Dennis Miller.
John is the John of yesterday. Even though he didn't actually write the words, he's still part of the songwriting process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So we have to have him here.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Well, let's kick it off. Hey, thank you for coming. This is the second annual NWR live podcast telethon for Child's Play Charity. I'm your host for this, well, at least for this part, actually. I'm Jonathan Metz. I'm here with the entire Radio Free Nintendo crew. That would be James Jones.
Hi.
Greg Leahy.
Oh, everyone.
John Lindemann.
Always a pleasure, Johnny.
And our guest and host, audio host, Michael Cole.
Hey, everyone.
That's TYP, and he will be hosting the call all day long. But this is just the first segment. Things change. Every hour we'll flip over and things will be totally different. You'll have new voices, so we'll reintroduce everyone often. Don't worry if you're a new listener. We have an IRC chat, as James mentioned earlier, and you can interact with us in there and interact with everyone else listening. Of course, the donation box is open all day long, and we really encourage you to put something in there if you haven't already. It's for a very, very good cause. That's Child's Play Charity. They provide games and toys to children in hospitals. In most cases, I think they're probably sick children or chronically ill children, but in some cases also children whose parents or other family members are sick and they have to be at the hospital for long periods of time to accompany them. So it's a really great charity. We'll be reminding you throughout the day. It is a telethon after all. But you don't have to call in to donate. You can just do it through PayPal right there. It's really easy.
Chip in.
And we thank everyone. We've already had a lot of money donated before the show even started. So thank you very much to everybody who did that. And we hope that we have given you lots of reasons to continue to donate so that we can go well into the day here. This could go on for about 9 hours if everything goes perfectly well.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's really exciting and scary and fun and that's part
dangerous.
Of the experience. Dangerous. So that's the introduction. We have so much crazy content here. It's just too complicated for me to even try to explain it all right now. It would take too long. So I will let them do it as they come on. So let's focus on this segment. We call this New Business. It's part of Radio Free Nintendo that we do every week. It's one of the podcasts here at NWR. Yeah, it's one of the podcast people. and New Business is where we sort of talk about what we've been doing lately, which means we talk about the video games that we have been playing, with all due respect to Garnett Lee. So I thought, James, since you were not on the podcast last week, maybe you could kick it off with the game that you've been playing the most, that you've been reviewing.
Yeah, so I'm going to have a big, wide load of games to talk about next week, but because of our time constraints, I'm only going to talk about one of the six games I had to talk about today. That is my most recent review copy, Ace Combat Assault Horizons Legacy, which is the game formerly known as Ace Combat 3D. Now, if you read my impressions of the game at E3, they might come off as morose is probably the best word to use for it, because this game looked bad, unmitigatingly terrible. I mean, it was slow, it looked ugly, the controls were wonky, the gameplay just didn't feel right, it didn't feel like an Ace Combat game, it didn't have any of the over-the-top drama that they put into those games, it didn't have the right ambiance, it just didn't feel – it felt like a rushed 3DS game. So it didn't have the Assault Legacy branding at the time, which I believe is the name of the spin-off game that's coming out for the consoles, or came out for the consoles earlier this year. It doesn't seem to be connected to the story of Assault Horizon. It seems to be just your generic Ace Combat made-up countries that are fighting over a continent. But so the branding was just tacked on. But they also apparently tacked on a good game from the E3 demo, because this feels like Ace Combat on a portable, which was – so when I got it and I was looking at the box, that was the first time I realized they had changed the name to Assault Horizons. And I was like, okay. I looked at the back. I'm like, well, this doesn't look like the 3DS game I played. This looks good. So I took it out and started playing it. And then an hour and a half later, I realized I'd been playing the game for an hour and a half. And the only way I could tell is that the 3DS is actually somewhat uncomfortable to hold for extended periods of time, at least for me. So the controls are all mapped pretty straightforward. A lot of the face buttons handle, you know, weapons and cycling targets. The shoulder buttons handle acceleration and brake, and the circle pad, slide pad, whatever your region calls it, handles controls. It really feels like the console Ace Combat games, just somewhat scaled down, primarily because of the hardware constraints. So you never get deal with 8,000 things on screen, but you can get a decent number on screen. It looks good. The terrain looks decent. There's a lot of 3D objects on the ground. The 3D effect I would actually compare to Namco, and I'm using Namco because that's what they put on the box, not Namco Bandai, which is kind of weird. But they use the 3D effect similar to how they used it in Ridge Racer. So sometimes it can feel a bit over the top. It looks almost like you have a 3D model sitting in a diorama, it much like it did in Ridge Racer. And in fact, on the 3DS launch screen, it actually has that same toy airplane sitting in a display case that they had in Ridge Racer. And I get the feeling that this game's development was greatly influenced by whatever they did for the Ridge Racer game, because it looks – I mean, both aesthetically and in terms of how they're using the effect, it seems to have taken a lot of the characteristics from that game and just dumped them on top of what was the E3 build, which didn't really resemble it that much to begin with.
So, I mean, Ridge Racer is well known for having a really aggressive 3D effect.
Yeah.
And I could imagine an Ace Combat game would be a really good showcase for 3D. How do you feel it works?
So what they did in this game is, I guess probably to save a lot of rendering, is that they didn't – a lot of the battles are air-to-air, and they're high in the, they're at high altitudes, so you don't always see the ground. A lot of times it's just open space with fighters, you know, 2 miles, 3 miles out in the distance. But you can go to the ground if you want to. And when I do, there's been a few missions where you're flying through closed spaces, like through a ravine. And that's very claustrophobic. And with the 3D effect all the way on, it's considerably worse. I don't mean worse as in like it's a less pleasant experience. I mean the claustrophobia is worse.
Yeah.
If you put the primary mode is third person, which parks you just back and above the jet's engines. So the jet itself has very aggressive 3D structuring. And when stuff passes by, it's really fast, so it's really hard to judge. But as stuff's coming in, the 3D effect is pretty good. But like I said, if it's just horizon, it's not always clear what you're looking at. But when you get down there, it can become much more aggressive. However, there's a mode that you can switch it to where you actually get a cockpit view, where there's just shit all over the screen because you're in the cockpit of an airplane. Mm-hmm. And the 3D in that is just over the top painful. I mean, there's like things in your cockpit that are further away from you, which really makes it hard to do anything effectively in the air because you're just going, oh my God, I can't see anything. And then you plow into the side of a mountain. But it's there. If you want to use it, you certainly can. I got through the ravine mission in that mode and said, never again, and switched it back to third person.
So, James, go ahead.
I was going to say, I just have to say, I'm really actually quite impressed with this game. I mean, it doesn't quite fill the full experience of the console games, but you wouldn't expect it to. Mm-hmm. The missions do seem a little bit shorter than their counterparts, which is probably a good decision for a handheld game. But they even managed to pump in a ton of voice acting, really good airplane models, decent GOI ground models. There's a couple missions in cities where they put big skyscrapers in, which is a nice touch. And it's even got the completely absurd over-the-top soundtrack booming in through missions to add for the ridiculous drama that series likes to put in there. I will say the story's not nearly as preposterous as it should be for an Ace Combat title, though, so I'm a little disappointed there. But beyond that, I'm having fun with it. All the dumb enemy babble is all preserved. Awesome.
Excellent.
So, James, the game that I was hoping you would come on the show and talk about this week, and you're not, is Freaky Forms.
No. Never tell me again.
Tell me why. I'm trying to explain. I thought this was one of your favorite demos from E3.
No, it was horrifying. It was
horrifying.
Traumatized.
I played it and I felt like somebody had slipped me acid. I mean, yes. I had no
Go
concept for what I was.
You say that like it's a bad thing, James. For you, it might actually calm you down.
Uh-huh. It's consequence-free drug tripping. I mean, what could be better? It's $7. You know, hallucinations.
I mean, when my primary objective in the stage was to collect poop, I was like, I'm going to pass.
Yeah.
They call it breaking trash. My own children in half.
Oh, they call it trash in the final version?
Yes, it's not called poop, unfortunately.
But
it's a localization thing, though.
It looks the part. I mean, it is what it is.
It looks kind of like an eggplant, actually. Sometimes, so the funny thing is that the normal trash is kind of purpley, and so it really does look like an eggplant. But then sometimes you'll get a quest, and it'll say, make golden trash.
Yeah.
So was that actually make golden poop previously?
Yes. And I'm not sure exactly why it's golden sometimes and not others. I think you just have to eat a certain combination of fruits and mushrooms and things. I'm not sure, but James, I find it really sad that you're not playing Freaky Forms because I know how you love to derisively laugh at games, and this game you can legitimately laugh at it because it is insanely funny, and everything that it does, it's almost more concerned with being funny than it is with being fun. But it's not funny because of clever writing or anything like that. It's just they've made this procedural character generator / animator.
Yes.
That cannot be not funny. I mean, like, no matter what you make, you can't make a creature in that thing that is not hilarious. You can't do it. And that, I think that's a feat. I think it's really impressive that they did that. And then they give you a world to kind of explore. The platforming's okay, but the main reason for the platforming is it lets you view the ridiculous animations and hear the crazy sounds that your creatures make. So
yes, I mean that was the other issue I had with the game where it felt like, okay, I need to get just over there, and I just launched myself into space.
Yeah, the controls are odd, but that's part of the fun also. I mean, if you think about like Katamari Damacy and Nobi Nobi Boy and stuff like that, they don't have perfect controls, probably on purpose, you know, because they want you to sort of struggle and miss things and flail around.
If it were five, I feel like I'd be more comfortable going and dealing with this game. At seven, it's a bit high for me, and considering one of the games I'm going to talk about next week is the Scott Pilgrim game, which I got for $6 on sale.
Oh, it's nice! Freaky Forms, there's more content to it than you might expect. I think there's quite a bit, and you unlock it progressively as you go. So it's not evident right at the beginning, but there's a lot of stuff in there. There really is, and I cannot wait for Street Pass, like for PAX East or whatever the next opportunity I get to do a lot of Street Pass, because you can share your creatures with other people.
Oh dear God!
I can't wait to see what other people made, because this is like the Mii Parade on crack. You know, it's like just I'm gonna be totally aghast at what other people have made, and vice versa when they see the stuff that I did. So I can't wait. It's going to be fantastic.
So according to our helpful sources, this game is made by former members of Skip, makers of things such as Captain Rainbow, another acid trip game,
and
Gift of Pia, whatever they call it.
Right, Gift of Pia or whatever it was. So yeah, they have a pedigree of making kind of wacky games.
Yeah. Okay, so we've had enough pleasure delay here, gratification delay. It's time to talk about Mario.
Yay.
So Greg has played a crap ton of it, and I've played a fair bit of it. And TYP?
I think I just started the seventh world. So.
Okay, you're about the same place I am then.
I just started the second stage.
Yeah, James.
I don't own a 3DS.
Yeah. Okay.
I have nothing to add to this conversation.
On that note, John.
Yes.
I think this is. I mean, if you like Mario games, I think this is like system seller tier.
I've heard very. I mean, obviously, you would always hear very good things about a Mario game, but yeah, I've heard it's a pretty old school. Has an old school Mario feel to it. So if you guys could enlighten me on that, it would be fantastic.
If I may, I when I was playing this game, it reminded me a lot of the conversation we had about Metroid Other M, in that, you know, this is sort of the 3D version of what I would have imagined for a Mario game, kind of like how Other M is sort of the sort of style that you might imagine would come from a 2D Metroid game going into 3D.
I know what you mean.
It's very kind of diorama-ish. It's very much a linear game. Although, I mean, Mario Galaxy games were pretty linear too for the most part, but it just has a feel of kind of, I mean, they're going for this Mario 3 kind of pulled into 3D, and I think they in a lot of ways succeeded. The level designs are crisp and short, very much like a Super Mario 3 level design, and I don't know why, but it controls really well, unlike my experience at E3. They must have subtly tweaked some stuff.
Yes,
I think it just takes some getting used to, because I found it took, like, when I played the demo, it took me a little while to get used to like how I should use the run button and the slide pad and all that kind of stuff. But having already had that experience when I played it now, hit the ground running, pretty much no problems. And it starts off quite gentle, so you've got time to get used to it. It's sort of irony that a game that's so based on, you know, the level sort of being placed along these sort of very specific angles, you know, sometimes it's sort of isometric, like, so it's sort of all 45 degree angles, or it's all straight ahead, or it's all to the side, and all that you've got an analog controller without those notches that are on pretty much every Nintendo analog controller there's ever been, when they would have actually been really quite useful in this case to lock in on the straight line. But, you know, it's still fine with the circle pad as is for me, but it's just sort of just bizarre that, you know, it seems like it was almost designed with those in mind, and yet here we have a controller that doesn't have them.
Yeah, it's a kind of an adaptation experience. I would assume.
But I mean, in terms of the nature of the design, like TYP says, I mean, it is a lot closer. Playing it now just kind of made me think, like, yeah, I think this feels like what I had in my head before I ever saw Mario 64. If I imagined Mario in 3D as a child, this is a lot more like what it would have been, you know. And I think in that sense, for the kids, or, you know, or older people, even, you know, that maybe have just been weaned on new Super Mario Brothers, this could well be a lot more accessible for them as a 3D Mario game, because if it's got that sort of, you know, more of a kind of intuitive connection to the 2D games, then maybe, you know, it will be a better kind of gateway drug for 3D Mario than the other ones have been.
Now, in terms of the gameplay itself, how well is the 3D effect incorporated into the gameplay?
Oh, God. You just asked a magic question, because it's one of those things, John, I was really skeptical of. I mean, Greg talked about this a lot. This was like his big hope for the game, was that, you know, it would really deliver on the idea that the 3D could actually upgrade the game in some way. And I thought, there's just no way. It's just too cosmetic, you know? And I think what they've done really carefully, and this is the real surprise of this game for me, because I'm enjoying it way more than I expected to. It is so much better. It's not so much better than I expected, but all the fears that I had about it, which I expressed on the show over the past few months, really they all kind of dissipated once I started playing it.
Same for me, Johnny.
I think there were real issues with it at the time of E3, or at least with that demo. Who knows how old it was at that point. But I think those issues were ironed out, and they really, really, really delivered on this game. And this is what I want to play on the 3DS. This is what I wanted to play on the 3DS from the beginning and didn't even know it. Because what they've done really, really well is not only use the 3D stereoscopic display extremely well, better than any other game by far that I've played. And part of it's because these environments are complex, so there's a lot of stuff that can be 3D. You can also use the D-pad to change whether the 3D is recessed or comes out of the screen towards you.
It's not
a huge difference between the two, but you'll notice it, and so you can kind of decide which one you prefer. And so in some cases, I might want to change it from level to level. So that's really nice. But more than all of that, I think what this game really nails, even more than Mario 64 or Galaxy or Sunshine, is that they actually use the 3D depth of the environment itself in a way that I haven't seen before, because it's not an exploration-based game, right? Because it is sort of old school, and that you're sort of really trying to get from point A to point B most of the time, maybe collect a special coin along the way. They have constructed these levels in really tight ways so that you actually have to think sometimes about where all these platforms are. And this is, I mean, you can turn the 3D effect completely off and this still applies. These diorama type levels that they've made are really intricate and really well put together, with lots of little secrets, but also just the way that you anticipate which direction an enemy is coming from, and the way that you time your jumps from one platform to another is really, really, really good. And I think the flagpole thing, which I thought was corny when I saw it at E3, and I thought was kind of out of place in these 3D worlds, you know, that they're providing, it turns out that the flagpoles are like little miniature puzzles, and there's always a way to get to the top of it, just like in the original Super Mario Brothers. But the way in which you get to the top of the flagpole usually involves you having really precise command of 3D movement over Mario. And when you do that, and when you get it right, it's very satisfying, and it makes you feel like, okay, now I get it. And this is something that they really didn't do very much in any of the previous 3D Mario games.
No, I mean, I think obviously whether the 3D works for you or not, it seems like it's very personal, you know, how people sort of deal with it, or, you know, whether it would help with gameplay. I mean, they do tend to limit the, like, really significant bits, like to the secret rooms, where you've got those, you know, sort of optical illusions almost, you know, and things like that, but where it makes sense if you could see the depth. But even there, you've got the option to, like, stand on the special tile, the eye tile, and then it shifts the view so you could see it if you were just playing a 2D or something. So, you know, everyone's going to be different on that. I mean, for me, I've played lots of all my 3DS games almost exclusively in 3D. It doesn't hurt my eyes. I like it. I'm good with it. But the key thing in this game is that whatever it does for an individual person, what I think it's done is it's emboldened Nintendo to do things with the design that they just weren't willing to do with 3D Mario before. Also, I'm sure being influenced by, you know, the success of the new Super Mario Brothers games and wanting to kind of get closer to that. James?
Do you feel willing to give an example of something they've been emboldened to do?
Well, I'll give you an example from the second half of the game. This is kind of like the post-game content-y kind of thing. But there's a part where you're doing speed runs, right? But the thing is, these speed runs are predicated on the fact that you have to kill an enemy to get extra time. So that means that basically they're asking you to bop Goombas with precision on a clock. They would never have asked you to do that in any previous Mario game. And you could punch them, or you could swish them, or you could do all this different stuff. Here, it's like, unless you've got, you might have a power up, maybe you could, you know, like fire flower them or something. So, because a lot of the time, it's just like, you've got to nail these guys first time, to even accumulate enough time to make it to the end, you know, with some time left on the clock. They never have even conceived of something like that before. They think that the 3D enables them to do that because, you know, you can judge it better, and maybe you can, maybe it seems like I didn't have a problem with it, so maybe it is helping me. But so I haven't played with the 3D off to kind of test that.
There are some roughly comparable stages in Galaxy 2, though, where there's time, basically kill sprees. You have to kill all the enemies in the stage.
It's time, but remember, in Galaxy 2, you've got that spin attack where you can fudge the jump, or you can just use the spin attack itself. I mean, again, if you've got the Tanuki suit or things, I mean, you could do a certain amount of similar stuff, but, you know, I haven't, you know, always got that, or I don't need it or anything like that. You know, you could just play this just jumping around, and you don't need to worry about it. That's the thing. I mean, I guess the Tanuki suit is kind of the replacement for like Flood or
the spin attack. That's what my feeling was.
But it works
better. You know, well, I actually really like Flood in terms of the hover ability. I'm a big fan of it because it takes finesse, you know, and it kind of has a startup and a shutdown time, and you can feather it. And it doesn't make the game super easy. It just gives you kind of another way in which to do the platforming stuff, and then they take it away all the time. And the Tanuki thing, I think, works in a similar way because it doesn't make the platforming that much easier. I mean, it doesn't let you get higher. You can't fly with it. It is really cute. Holy crap. It's really, really cute. But it gives you an attack that you don't need that often, it seems like. But the main thing it does is it just lets you be a little bit more in some cases, it lets you get to somewhere you couldn't get before because of a long distance. But for the most time, it just lets you fudge it just a little bit. But it still takes a little bit of skill. There are times when it can actually make you overconfident and screw you up, which is kind of fun. But it's not – it doesn't break the game by any means, you know?
No.
No, I mean, I had
and you don't have it all the time.
I had an interesting experience last night playing where I was on an airship, and I just kept dying at the boss, and I was just kind of being, I guess, a little too sloppy. It was one of the later airships, and one time I got to the boss with no power-ups whatsoever. I was just little Mario. I'm like, well, this isn't going to go so well, but I beat it because I was focused, and, you know, all it takes is focusing and being careful to beat those guys.
Sometimes I was kind of not particularly fussed about picking up the Tanuki leaf if I had a chance, you know, because I just kind of like the feel of it the way it normally is, you know, just you get into a rhythm, you know, kind of classic Mario kind of
well
thing.
And the fire flower is much more potent offensively, so if you're doing a lot of combat or there's a lot of nasty enemies up ahead, you might want to hang on to the fire flower instead.
The
fire flower is real nice. I mean, this is the first time it's been done right in 3D. Yeah.
And what I love is that this Mario game actually lets you make that choice, because it's been so long since we had a 3D Mario where you actually we've never really had a 3D Mario where you get a power up that's not timed.
Yeah, I
mean, there's actually strategy here. You actually have to choose which one is the best for me right now.
The closest thing I could say is kind of in Galaxy 2, there's a few green stars. This is your real super obscure stuff. There's a few green stars where, like, to get them, you've got to hold on to the cloud hat for ages so that you've still got a platform you can make to get to some really out of the way star stuff. But I mean, that is it. You know, I mean, this is obviously completely different because the power-ups work, you know, precisely as they did in the side-scrolling game. So that, and I like that. I mean, the thing is, obviously, what you don't have is kind of like, you know, the Mario World type of thing where you want to keep the cape to find some completely like secret exit or anything like that. You know, the power-ups don't have that kind of applicability.
Is there any instances of things like secret exits in this game, or is it all just pretty straightforward linearity?
I found one warp zone because it was teased at E3, but it doesn't really do anything other than jump you to the next world. It isn't like it's a branching path or unlock anything, as far as I can tell.
No, and it's very much like, I mean, you know, it's even more stripped down as a kind of map now, isn't it? You know, even perhaps even more to the Galaxy 2.
Yeah,
I mean, I would say
more than like Mario 3. I mean, it's just a straight line.
I mean, New Super Mario Brothers was kind of like a sort of toned down version of some of the maps before, but this is literally just a line. You go from one level to the next. There's no kind of fanciness. And you save after every level.
Right.
Or you save at the once you beat a castle or a ghost house.
It's analogous to Super Mario Brothers DX for the Game Boy Color.
Right.
Sure.
And I mean, it makes sense because it is portable and all that. But it does make the sort of antique kind of concept of live seem even more so, you know.
Yeah, like, I've got like 110 right now.
Because these levels are short. And I mean, they do have checkpoints, so there's that. But, you know, the rate they're giving them out, I mean, you know, the way this is constructed, you know, there really is, they probably should have just done away with it by now.
Yeah, I mean, for reference, like I said, I've completed two stages and I was at 14 lives. Two stages, I'd gotten to 14.
Yep.
That's absurd.
You know, and Uncle Bob just mentioned something in the chat, but I think it is kind of sad that New Super Mario Brothers on DS has a better world map than this game. But that's the only thing that's better about it, because I think 3D Land is on a completely different tier than New Super Mario Brothers, either for DS or for Wii. Now, the Wii game is certainly much better than the DS game. And it's also got multiplayer, which is a huge thing. But I think the level design is better, and it's just more fun and challenging in general. And the part of the problem with the DS game is it's really easy. But I just think there's so much more thought put into this game. There's so much more design. There's so much more interesting stuff to do, and there's just more variety. You know, it really feels like there was just way more effort put into this than there was for the DS game. And I think as a player, you feel that and you appreciate it, you know. And I'm really looking forward to getting to the next level, whereas in the DS game, I kept waiting for something to happen. You know, like this thing about how in 3D Land, you get to the end and then you sort of open up the second quest or whatever. In the DS game, I kept sort of waiting for something like that to happen because the stuff that I was playing wasn't really doing it for me. And then, of course, that never happened. You know, it just ends. And you go back and try to find all the coins. And, it's, you know, if you trying to get all the coins can be a little bit challenging, but there's just no comparison for me. This is it's a totally different developer and everything, but, man, this is a completely – this is such a better game.
It feels more analogous with the efforts they made on platform Mario games. Like it feels like they put the same level of effort they put into this that they put into like Sunshine.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few things about it that I think betray the fact that this was probably made on a pretty quick turnaround. Let's not forget, you know, EAD Tokyo, they did Galaxy 2, you know, 18 months ago. You know, and then obviously they would have wanted to get this out as soon as possible, you know, to give the 3DS the big game it needed. And, you know, like this music that's kind of just like borrowed straight out of Galaxy, but kind of the fidelity's lesser. And, you know, some of the concepts are taken from Galaxy, like this kind of, you know, the rhythm based, like disappearing platforms and the blue and red switching ones and all that, which, you know, but they're good ideas. But then sort of when the aesthetic is similar, it does kind of feel like you play with bits and pieces of a game that already existed. But there's nothing wrong with that in a gameplay sense. I mean, I just think, you know, it just kind of betrays the fact that they did probably threw this together, you know, as quickly as they could in some ways, but they still did a really, really good job of it. But it, for me, this is really exciting where they could take it. Because, you know, I think they were concerned about making it accessible. They were concerned about making it, you know, it's pretty easy, the first part of the game. Although I still think it's more interesting than something like New Super Mario Brothers, which was also easy. If it's easy and interesting, I can deal with that, you know. On the other hand, it's a bit more problematic. But, you know, they could, in the future, if this is a hit and they feel like, well, this is a new kind of path along which we can develop the Mario 3D sort of template, I think they could get to something really good. You know, if you kind of have like a kind of progression, like from Mario 3 to Mario World applied to this game, you know, I think there's some really exciting possibilities there.
Yeah, I mean,
3D Land 2. James' head will explode if they make Super Mario 3D Land 2.
You can't do that. That's some GBA level bullshit numbering right there. Super Mario World 3 Advanced 4.
I'm looking forward to Mario Kart 7-2.
I very much agree with Greg on those sentiments. It does feel like there are places where you can tell it was kind of on a rush schedule, but they did a really good job of prioritizing what they wanted to do. You know, they decided, well, let's make some short levels that are really interesting rather than try to rush something out there. And in that sense, it does remind me a little bit of some of the stuff they did for like Super Mario Land 2, where it's scaled down, but they still are putting in, you know, some good effort.
Yeah, there's definitely. I did feel the Super Mario Land 2 kind of thing going on a little bit, having played that recently. I mean, some of it as well, I think, you know, in terms of it's very much like, you know, Galaxy or something like that. But on the other hand, like, because the way it's on the handheld, you know, lower res and all that, you know, it does kind of, the play field is not that big. You know, no. Feels like it's a bit more intimate. And that's a lot like, you know, the big chunky sprites on a Game Boy kind of thing. So, I mean, I think the pace. Yes, you'll probably play with the run button held down the vast majority of the time, but the pace is maybe a little slow, but it fits. They definitely made it fit the amount of real estate that you're working with. Once you get down into it, I never felt like he's too slow for the stages at all. It's all carefully balanced for the level design. So in that sense, it is a bit like, you know, some of those Game Boy games that would have had to do the same thing obviously they were, if you wanted to have a sprite of any detail, it kind of left you with little room to play with.
Well, yeah, it goes back to our discussion on Metroid 2, where it was like,
yeah, that didn't handle it as well as Mario Land 2, though. I would
say. No, it handled it about as worse as you could possibly handle it, to be honest. Short of Samus being the only thing in screen while everything shoots you from the edge.
I mean, I think the boss is probably for
haters gonna hate.
Yeah, you
can always play Sonic Game Gear game, guys.
The bosses fall closer to New Super Mario Brothers than Galaxy, especially Galaxy. I like the bosses quite a lot in Galaxy 2. Here, a lot of them are a bit nondescript and
so.
But I will say the sort of the last boss, or if you want to even call it that, because you know there's a lot of game after that point. But that is really good. And it's because it's about platforming, which really is what Mario bosses should be like. But so, you know, if you think
kind
about
like the end of New Super Mario Wii,
exactly, that was really good, really, and this really is good. Very much the same sort of playbook. But you know,
so
in 3D, in terms of just in 3D space, you're dazzling around all these different platforms and pathways, and it's really intense and great. Awesome. That's how it should be.
I've got two questions, really. So first off. Could they have conceivably, with some modification, but not much, gone ahead and called this New Super Mario Brothers 3-D or whatever the hell pun they wanted to put into it?
They could have called it Super Mario 4, as far as I'm concerned.
But I mean,
it's already Mario World, Johnny.
Super Mario 3-2.
Because I mean, it does feel a bit. I mean, from what I've played at E3 and what I've played here, it does feel a bit. Closer to the New Super Mario Brothers mold than the 3D Mario mold. I mean, could they?
I don't know. I mean, first of all, there's like the internal politics of that in terms of, you know.
I understand.
whether that would ever like constitute an obstacle to that kind of branding exercise, I don't know. But I mean, I don't know how effective this moniker is going to be in selling it. But I mean, it does borrow a lot of things, but it does synthesize its own sort of new thing at the same time. I mean, I can understand them wanting to sort of distinguish it in a sense and say, you know, this is something that you haven't played before. I mean, that's part of the appeal, you know, especially when you try to sell someone a new system. I mean, it'd be a bit different if this was for a system that everybody already owned and you were just trying to maximize sales from that point of view. There is I think what they were going for with the 3D Land is sort of to give it that sort of, this is, you know, an exclusive, it's uniquely possible on the 3DS. You know, whether that's really true or not, that's what they're trying to sort of signify. And so maybe they could have called it something different, but I don't think that fit in with their objective.
It wasn't so much a marketing question as it was like from a gameplay standpoint. Like I said, I have a very limited perspective on this game. But
I know what you mean. But even from the gameplay perspective, like I said, I think it's definitely different enough that, you know, you could have called it the Galaxy Portable if you wanted to, but you know, it does have the
space. Well, there's no Galaxy.
Yeah, you could easily have put a space theme in this because all the levels are just in a void. I mean, they really, you know.
I'm so glad they didn't, because I mean, obviously, I'm a space kind of person. but I love the fact that it has its own sort of identity. And also, I think where the Galaxy games lost me quite often is that there's too much of Mario flying through the air on rails and you just kind of trying to pick up star bits, you know. It's very pretty. It's very cinematic, but you're not really playing very much during those bits. And it's not like there's entire levels of that, but they really kind of interrupt the good platforming of the Mario Galaxy games. So well, I'm kind of glad that that stuff is out because this feels more like a real platforming
game. If I had a disagree button, I would be slamming it right now and just banging on it for the next 20 minutes.
So you mean, flying through space and Galaxy.
But I think some of it is the grandeur. I mean, think about Galaxy.
The music and everything. I get it. It's an experience. But as gameplay, it's not very interesting.
But moreover, I don't think they could have replicated that on 3DS the same way. So I mean, you know, or certainly doesn't make sense to kind of push the boat out to try and do that. You know, I think you think of the Galaxy games, you get these moments like when the buoy base Galaxy opens up to reveal a hemisphere of water and you go inside and the melty monster with their faces coming out of the lava and you're slingshotting in between them. That kind of stuff is not here. It's much more pure platforming, focused, streamlined. And there's, I think there's good points about that, like what Johnny says. There's a bit less of the kind of the frippery. But on the other hand, you don't have the same sense of wonder. But, you know, I think that probably would have been a bit of a fool's errand. I just don't think they could have.
No, I don't think it would have worked. There. I mean, ultimately, those things exist for the sake of showing off the Wii's unique functionality, which is its pointer stuff. I mean, that's what it's there for. The reason they take away the control for everything else is because they want you to make good use of the pointer at that moment.
But you're not really making good use of it. You're picking up little things that are almost inconsequential.
It is good. No, they're not inconsequential because you need to feed them to that fat bastard.
It's true.
Yeah. No, there are pointer-based levels in the Galaxy games that are much more interesting, where you're pulling him and slingshotting him across and blowing the bubble around. The space stuff, I agree. It's totally pretty. It's really impressive. It's very interrupting to the really fun part of the game for me, and so I kind of prefer this more pure platforming. And like Greg said, I mean, they've taken away enough moves that – even though this is a 3D Mario game, it feels a hell of a lot different than Mario 64, where you're punching and kicking and doing somersaults and, you know, triple jumps. And there's no triple jump in this game. So you really have to depend on his basic jumping move. You know, I mean, that is the primary way you kill enemies in this game, is you jump on their heads. And you can't say that for any other 3D Mario game.
Can you wall jump?
And again, I think some of the if you go back to Mario 64, the reason why they probably had a lot of the punching and all that kind of stuff is that they thought that people would find it difficult to effectively jump on enemies and all that kind of stuff. And like I said, whether the 3D effect does it for you or not, what makes me happy is it gave them the impetus to say, let's try it. Let's try a more straight up Mario game in 3D, and it works.
So what I'll be curious to see, I mean, and it won't be for me, but all the people that grew up on the 2D Mario games and never played the 3D Mario games, maybe they're new Mario fans, or maybe they just never played the 3D games, like kind of like the Famicast guys were talking about. Are they going to be able to play this game? Are they going to enjoy the parts that are more 3D in the sense that it's not left or right with a little bit in and out, but you're really going into the screen? Because there's some levels that are definitely more of a different perspective than they're used to.
I mean, again, the top-down stuff. I mean, they never would have done that without this whole stereoscopic thing. I don't think they would have had the boldness to say, let's do whole levels where you're just looking straight down. We got the Zelda bit, but some of those bits with the propeller block, which is pretty much all about that. You know, you've got to sort of... Especially if you're risking getting a star coin, you know, you've got to sort of land on an enemy and then activate the propeller and all. It's totally vertical, which is...
And it works really well.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how I'll react to it because I certainly like the 2D games more than the 3D games. So I'm hoping this will be kind of like a perfect blend between the two.
Right. So, and I was really skeptical that they could do that, but I think they actually have. I really do. So we should move on. I mean, we've been talking for about 30 minutes about Mario, and I doubt anyone listening is really going to complain about that since it's a Nintendo show. But
I had one last question I was going to ask real quick. It's very quick.
Okay.
And Greg had mentioned that the final boss is very platformy. So does that mean Tokyo EAD finally made a Mario game with good bosses? please.
No, like I said, the ones in the middle are totally, you know, bop it on the head a few times, and then you did, they just, you know, vary it up a little bit, but they repeat a bit. You know, it's like those are not brilliant by any stretch of the imagination.
The Bowser fights can be interesting in that it's hard to find a window to get under him.
Yeah, I like that. We'll get anything that's just more about, you know, about Mario's core skill set, which is the actual traversal, the platforming, I think is a better way to go. I mean, it'd probably be a bit of a stretch to do that for every boss in the game if you're going to have a lot of bosses. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I kind of would have liked if the mix was a bit stronger in that direction in this case.
I don't know, guys. Mario's never really been about bosses. Well,
it hasn't. But if you're going to have them, I'd like them good.
Sure. You know? No, I don't dispute with that.
But I mean, the Bowser Jr. boss fights in Galaxy 2 were actually pretty good.
They are good.
They are.
And they're varied, but then you get to the Bowser fights and you're like, I want to die. I mean,
or if you get to the very last one, apparently Bowser wants to die rapidly.
Yeah.
10 seconds.
Yeah. All right. So we do have a couple other games I wanted to bring up before we wrap up this hour. And John, I know you have been super busy. This time of year is probably pretty rough for you. But are you planning to pick up? I mean, Zelda comes out tomorrow, and we have a whole hour about Zelda coming up. But
yeah, I am definitely picking it up tomorrow. I
shield
got
your
my
ears
text.
For spoilers.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to shield. Definitely, I'm going to drop off.
There won't
off,
be any spoilers.
It's live though. So
there will be. There will be spoilers. I mean, we can't stop it if it happens. I mean.
Don't we have a 10-second delay button? What if someone
we don't. If John just starts dropping F-bombs, the FCC's all over us.
No, I'm really looking forward to it. Definitely, I mean, it's going to be a great game. I mean, hopefully it lives up to everything that I think it's going to be. So, you know, I'm kind of going into it with an open mind. You know, it's getting, you know, several, I think, 10 out of 10 scores, even from outlets that never give anything a 10 out of 10 or pretty much love to go against the grain. So,
And 7.5, which
Well, you know, they'll probably talk about that next hour, but I thought that, you know, I saw Shane Bettenhausen tweeted about it and said, you know, amateurish and, you know,
yeah, I was kind of surprised.
No respect for this. And I read the review. I don't know that I will agree with it when I play the game. I can't say right now. I didn't think it was badly written. I've seen much worse reviews, you know. I thought that, you know, the person had criticisms of the game, which were things that I was kind of anticipating that some people would say, and I think there will be a segment of the population that will agree with that review. And hopefully it'll be small, you know, hopefully most of us will like it a lot more than a 7.5, whatever that means. But I didn't think it was an outlier, you know. I didn't feel like this was like an Armand White or whatever who's trying to, you know, intentionally go against the grain and write some kind of incendiary thing. I didn't get that sense from it. I've read those reviews before, and I don't think this is one of them. So
was the issue that the story is just kind of amateurish?
No, actually, it wasn't the story. It was he had some problems with Motion Plus. It didn't work very well for him, and you know, that's maybe a calibration thing, or maybe he just wasn't used to it, had never used it before.
I'm going to be there. I'm totally going to be –
Which, how many Motion Pluses do you own?
I have a Motion Plus, but I've like barely used it.
Yeah. I've played Resort at your house, Mike, so I know you have one.
That's right, because that was what, like the second time you had played Resort was when we were there?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It had been out a year.
No, I think it's just a personal experience with the technology maybe didn't go very well, and maybe he played it wrong. You know, I mean, it's possible he just didn't set it up correctly. And the other thing was, you know, complaining about the structure, which I think is interesting because some people think that it's too much like other Zelda games, and some people are talking about how incredibly different it is than other Zelda games. And so it's all subjective, but I didn't think it was a insane, psychotic, you know, review. But they'll probably talk about it next hour. So, Greg, briefly, since you're not going to be on the next segment, I know you've been playing a little bit of it at least.
I am going to be on the next segment.
He is going to be on the next
segment. Oh, you are? Oh.
Come on, we talked about this. We've talked about this.
Sorry, it's been a crazy few days. Okay, well then, hold that thought.
I will.
So let's move on. One other game that I wanted to bring up is called Wizorb. And it's not a Nintendo game, but it has a very strong connection that I'll explain in a sec. This is an Xbox indie game, and I heard about it on Giant Bomb. They did some interviews with the guys, and they're really Patrick Klepek was really pushing it really hard. And I was like, you know, I mean, there's a free trial, so I'll check it out. And it sounded kind of interesting. It's an Arkanoid style game. And I've heard it called like an Arkanoid RPG. That's not true. It's not an RPG. There are some fantasy elements to it. There's some tactical elements to it, but it's not a persistent kind of RPG thing. So, you know, if you don't like Alpha, whatever it's called on DSiWare, don't worry, because it's not like that. It is an Arkanoid style game that. Have any of you ever played Pinball Quest for the NES?
Oh, I love Pinball Quest. It's awesome.
All right.
No, I have not.
So, Mike, let me tell you right now, you need to play Wizorb, because this is basically Pinball Quest, but with Arkanoid instead of pinball.
Huh.
So, you know, Pinball Quest is not really an RPG. It's a pinball game where you kind of get money and you buy items, right. But it's level by level. And it's still played like pinball, except the thing that I remember the most of Pinball Quest, I haven't played it in 20 years probably, but I loved it when I was a kid. I always wanted it to come out in Virtual Console. But what I remember the most about it is not the RPG elements, but just that it had a setting, you know? So instead of these abstract pinball boards with bumpers and flashing lights and stuff, it was set in kind of a world where you're playing pinball in locations. So you're playing it in a castle, and you're playing it in a town, and you're playing it in a dungeon, right? Or you're playing it out in a field. And so it still works mechanically, and a lot of the things that you expect to be in pinball are there. They just look like different things, but you really feel like you're kind of in a location, you know, and especially on the NES, you know, we used our imaginations a lot, and it was pretty easy to believe that. Wizorb sort of takes the same thing, but with Arkanoid. So instead of these neon-colored blocks that mean nothing, you're kind of breaking into castles, and you're playing through towns, and there are enemies, you know, there's bats and monsters and stuff like that. And it's all done in the style of an 8-bit NES game. So even though it's on Xbox, and I think they're porting it to Steam and maybe phones or something like that, but it looks and sounds exactly like an NES game. So great music, fantastic pixel art graphics, just brilliant stuff. I mean, it's just a beautiful tribute to NES games, and probably, I mean, I'm sure they had Pinball Quest in mind when they made this. They had to, because it reminds me so much of it. And the really nice thing about it is that it takes the Arkanoid formula, and instead of giving you experience points or anything like that, it doesn't do any of that. There's also no power-ups, which is one of the problems I have with that DSiWare games. There's just too many power-ups. You can't remember what they all do, and some are good for you, some are bad for you. Some of them just make it impossible to play. Some of them make it way too easy. In this game, there are no power-ups. The only thing that comes down is either money, which you use outside of, you know, but sort of between levels to buy, like, help items. But the other thing is magic vials that fill up your magic meter. So you have these four magic spells. Two of them you can use when the ball's in the air, and two of them you can only use at the moment that the ball hits the paddle. And you know, you only need two buttons to play it, because it's an NES game, right? So it's just A or B, basically. And so you use these whenever you feel it's appropriate. So it becomes very tactical. So you've got a certain amount of resource in your magic meter that can be filled up if you play well. But you kind of choose how to use that up. So you have these abilities. You can make the ball, you know, go through blocks without bouncing off of them for a couple of seconds. You can push it with a blow of wind. You can sort of change the trajectory in mid-flight. You can do all this really cool stuff, but it costs you something. You have to choose when to do it. And it makes the gameplay very, very engaging, and it also keeps you from getting in these situations where it seems like you're kind of bouncing it into the corner, into the empty corner over and over, and you can never get it out of there, you know? Yeah. So it gives you ways out of that situation. Also, the ball physics are fantastic. The controls are really, really good. The best Arkanoid controls I've ever played on a joystick. Really excellent control. It's like $3, man. It is so good. So if you've got an Xbox 360, I really recommend that you try it out. You know, there's a free trial. It's called Wizorb, and it should be coming out to PC and other stuff soon. This game would be fantastic on WiiWare. I'm sure it would easily fit into the file size limit. And it would be great on 3DSware, eShop stuff. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's really, really good. So if you love the old NES style games, especially Arkanoid or Pinball Quest, definitely check it out. All right, now let's see what's going on here. We just got a 10-minute warning. I know we crossed $1,500 earlier.
Woo.
Actually, we're almost up to $1,600.
That is going to go so far towards my tab.
Great. Yep, that's right.
Which will unlock the radio trivia segment with TYP and Greg. Well, we definitely want that to happen. It's going to be awesome. And there will be prizes for that, too. If you haven't,
we have prizes to unload, so we need that segment.
Yeah, if you haven't looked at this, on the page where the audio player is, there's also the chat room. You go on down, there's a schedule of all the different segments we've got. Under that, there's this humongous prize list. Including about a dozen video games that people have donated, staff members as well as fans like Uncle Bob. And there's some really, really good stuff, a lot of variety there. So basically, if you win anything in radio trivia or Jeopardy, then you just get to pick whatever you want out of there. So it's there's some really good stuff. I'm sure everyone can look at that and find something that they would like to have. Well, guys, we have a little bit of time before the Zelda segment. What if we take a caller?
Okay, well, Carl, can you help us out here?
Probably have time for one call. And while we set this up, I think Carl should have. Okay. So if you want to, all right. So Carl is our assistant for this segment, and if you want to call in, send a Skype message to Carl, that with a K, dot Castaneda, Castaneda. So Carl is asking them to IM you, and we will get a caller in here as soon as possible.
Right, and if you don't have a Skype account, you should create one, because you'll need it if you want to dial in for the radio trivia segment or any other segments later today.
Call in Bonanza in a couple of hours. Yep. Okay, so... all right. While Carl works on that, I think he asked us to inform everyone about sort of the way that the next hour is going to go, because I'm sure Neil is gearing up for this. We've got some people lined up to talk about Zelda who've really been playing the game a lot. The first hour will be kind of a roundtable discussion. These are mostly people who've played the game or beaten the game or reviewed the game. Maybe in some cases not quite there, but they've played a lot of it. And then for the second half, they're going to be taking questions from the chat. So, you know, Zelda's not out in North America, at least. So if there's something you want to know, we're not talking about spoiler stuff. We're not like, what item do you get in the sixth dungeon? We're not talking about that kind of stuff. But, you know, like, what about this controls? Did you ever have problems with this? Do you think the story kind of lives up to what we expect? Do you think, you know, the world is interesting? Did they mess up the structure enough that it's kind of unpredictable and surprising? All that kind of stuff. Anything you want, they will be taking questions, because these are the real experts on Zelda right now. So Carl is taking questions. Yes.
This isn't working.
I guess we weren't expecting to take a call this early in the show. So
no, we had time.
Well,
so James, you said you had other games you could talk about. You want to briefly talk about those games?
One thing I wanted to mention about Ace Combat, just quickly. Do you see how it would or wouldn't benefit from the Circle Pad Pro dual analog controls, Ace Combat?
I could see how it might make a difference, but it works okay anyway.
Right, it's hardly necessary, but you think it might give it a bit of a benefit.
Yeah. Hey, our Colin's here.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey,
Donald.
Hey.
Let's go ahead and introduce yourself.
I'm Shaman in the chat room.
Hey, man. What's going on?
Not too much. Just digging the first hour so far, and hopefully we get some more money so we can get you the radio trivia later on.
I'm sure we'll get there.
I think we're well on our way. So Donald created the GAF thread. So I thank you very much for that, sir.
No problem.
I'm sure that helped bring in a few people. And, of course, it's still going. So people are posting in it even as the show goes on. So really appreciate that. Where are you calling from, man?
Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, Canada.
Nice.
Very nice. Fellow Canadian. Welcome. Yep. Welcome.
He's a
Do you even
Scotian.
Call yourself that anymore, John? Officially defected now.
It has not been filed yet. The paperwork is still in process.
You are stabbing your nation in the back with paperwork.
Did you have a question or anything for us, or you just want to chat?
Just had a question here. Based on what we heard this week, that EA is trying to get trying to get Origin as sort of the exclusive online service for Wii U, would that work for us, or do we want it to be the Wild West where we can have a Steam and Origin, Uplay, whatever, on the Wii U? Or obviously we'd probably all prefer Xbox Live, but we know that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I'd like to see how it's going to be, how it would actually work on Wii U. You know?
Yeah.
Using Origin, what does that actually mean? You know?
I know that EA would like to get the Origin service on as many devices as they can simply because they have an uphill battle with Steam already existing. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure why they would what would be their motivation for devoting the development of an entire service for Wii? Because obviously it's going to have to be a custom version of the service. It's going to have custom software on it. You're not going to be able to just install PC versions of the software, I would presume. But that would mean that if this is really what they're doing, they would have big plans for the system because they're going to devote significant resources to it. Now, it may be that they feel like they can develop things and then cross-platform release these games, but that would mean they'd have to manage to get Origin on all the hardware, either this gen or next gen. And if it's next gen hardware, I'm not sure what Wii U software would be compatible with the new stuff because it's very much likely to be more powerful than the follow-up systems for the next two consoles.
Well, Steam on PS3 really doesn't do much beyond
lets you play what, Portal 2, and is that it?
Well, I'll tell you what it does, and I should have mentioned this when I talked about Portal 2 about a month ago when we finished the co-op stuff, but I was playing on my PS3, my friend Kevin was playing on his Mac.
Okay,
now that is pretty cool.
That is pretty cool, definitely.
It is cool, but I mean that's the only game on it, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is. And, you know, I don't think Sony certainly intended for Valve to be selling games over Steam through to your PS3. What would be nice is if this had happened. I mean, look, PS3's been out for 5 years, so it's a little late to the party to be launching Steam on it.
Yeah.
I think though what it sets up is the possibility that PlayStation 4 or whatever, PlayStation 3.5 or whatever they do, could have something like this on there from the beginning. And if it did, even if you're not buying games through Steam, because I'm sure Sony wants to be the exclusive purveyor of downloadable games, right, through the PSN store. But I think what it means is that you might be able to have Steam multiplayer compatibility over a lot of games, right?
Yep.
over the generation. And that's kind of what I'm looking forward to with this Origin thing. I mean, if it's true, I think it could be a good thing just in the sense that, you know, I don't think you'll only be playing EA games over it, and I don't really even think they'll be selling games over it. I think Nintendo will still want to control their own store because then they control the profits. But what it means is it's a way to manage your friends list. It's a way to see what people are playing. It's a way to see who's online. It's a way to make matchmaking work. And it's out of Nintendo's hands, which I think is good.
Let's just say that we have to wrap this up real quick, but I could totally see Nintendo doing what they did with the DS originally when they launched its online service and just saying, all right, we're going to let you develop from the ground up our infrastructure since we suck at this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just basically, they're basically just subletting the work out. And if that's what they're doing, that would be wonderful because whatever EA produces, and I know Origin's widely hated, but whatever EA produces will be better than what Nintendo makes on their own.
Yeah.
Regardless of what it was.
Origin just started. So they're, you know,
Steam, and it's already better than the Wii.
Steam was hated when it first launched too. It's the kind of thing that's the thing also is that they'll probably, if they do Origin on Wii U, they'll probably be able to update it frequently and make it better, which Nintendo is not going to do with their service. So we've got to go. Donald, thank you very much for calling in.
No problem.
About half of us are about to drop off the call and we're going to bring
Peace.
On and some other people, Andy. So,
and most of us are going to be back for a segment after this next one. So.
Yep, right. We'll be back for listener mail in a couple of hours. But Mike, are you controlling the call here? Do you want?
Yeah, I'll bring Andy and and kneel in.
All right.
Yep. All right.
All right. Thanks, all right. Donald.
Hang on for just a sec, people. We got to make a little transition here, and we'll get started with the Zelda Review Roundtable.
Let's talk about Zelda, the Skyward
just like,
Sword.
Hi, just like magic, the voices change.
So, Andy, have you finished the game at this point?
No, I would have, but
okay.
other plans kind of prohibited me from finishing the game. I'm at the last dungeon, which...
Yeah, you were on the cusp.
Yeah. Based on what I've seen so far, the last dungeon, and based on what you've told me, I expect that I have at least two more sit downs with the game remaining, which have to happen before Monday because I'm sending the game back to you on Monday. So,
but so you're on the cusp of beating a game, and Greg, you got it what, 2 or 3 days ago?
It was Thursday you got here, yeah. So I've had it, it officially came out yesterday, but a bit of early shipping, so I've had time to play it for a few hours, beat the first couple of dungeons, so I've got a feel of kind of the rhythm of the first part of the game anyway. I could certainly talk about playing it a bit, but I could also act at least for the first half an hour of this as a sort of proxy for the people in the chat that want to ask questions as well, probably, because I certainly have plenty of it's been encouraging and thought provoking, I would say.
Yeah. I guess the natural first place to go is the motion plus controls, which, as I talked about in my review and kind of talked about before then too, is that at first I kind of didn't like them that much, and then as I got farther into the game, I got to a point where I don't really know if I want to go back and play other Zelda games because of how much I like these controls. I know, Andy, you've probably reached that point of whether you've come to your conclusion on these controls, and Greg, you're probably still early on with it. But what do you guys feel about that?
I certainly feel like the controls work very well. They work more or less exactly as advertised. I think there's a little bit of the sword play can be a little bit tricky simply because the enemies seem to be really good at reading your arm motions. So you have to be kind of tricky and wait for them to give you an opening, because if you just go in trying to attack from the side or from the back, they'll block you seemingly for a good 2 minutes before you realize that you have to wait for them to give you an opening.
Yeah. One of the enemies I run across in the second dungeon was the Lizalfos, knights. And with them, I almost do like a dummy attack, because then they sort of shield themselves in a very particular way, which gives
they
you...
They do their little
they'll give you very specific opening. Once they shield, then it's like, well, okay, if I go sort of diagonal left to right, down to up kind of thing, that's going to get them, or it's almost getting a bit punch outy. You do one thing to create another opening. It seems like there's kind of fewer enemies in compared to some Zelda games, but more considered, and I'm in favor of that. And it's very much a logical decision, considering you're going to be waving your arm around. You don't want to be doing that ceaselessly. But even with some of the lesser enemies,
The fewer number of enemies in the game is all that noticeable. I think there's a little bit of repeat, but...
Well, the one thing that they do, and they've talked about this in some of the Iwata asks, about how they have the technical term is bokoblins, which are like the kind of generic... I mean, I thought they were moblins. I don't really know what the hell the damn difference is. But it's basically like the generic, like kind of like orc looking creature. And in the different areas of the game, they kind of have different abilities. Like in one, they might just have a sword, and another one, I'm kind of avoiding speaking in specifics because I don't want to spoil anything for anyone that's been keeping it free. But basically they have different like ticks and different weapons and stuff that they wield, and that changes throughout the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've already come across that already. I mean, just to get a little bit specific, but you've got certain enemies early on. You'll fight them, and they'll block, and you're better off doing what Andy says, which is wait for them to
or use your shield. Even the shield is really useful.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the shield's useful, but of course it's sort of consumable now because it'll break. So they're trying to kind of dissuade you from just sitting there and absorbing attacks and waiting forever. They're kind of trying to force you to action a little bit. But, you know, at first you can kind of clatter their sword as much as you like to some, you know, what I mean, before, I mean, it'll be annoying because you want to kill these guys, you want to get on with it. But then later on you get into situations where, you know, if you do that, it'll actually hurt you. You know, with certain weapons, so you know, you really have to be much more considered about how you approach these guys. So I like that personally so far. I mean, again, I don't know whether I'd like it if it turns into a, you know, killing a horde of guys like that. But the occasional one kind of paced out. I mean, is that how it plays out over the course of the game? Would you say?
I mean, that's generally how it works out. I mean, you know, like for instance, like you'll fight Stalfos, and the first time you fight one, I think it's actually somewhere early on in the game. And it's kind of set up as like a mini boss. And then later on in this game, those enemies kind of are almost recurring enemies where it's like instead of, you know, having that be a big reward, it's just like that's an enemy in the dungeon. And they do that a lot. And I'm trying to think of I know there was another game that I thought of like when I was playing this that I was like, hey, it reminds me of that, how it introduces these bosses and then those bosses become almost regular enemies. Like I think a game like Bayonetta does that as well, where they introduce these really cool bosses and then they just become regular enemies later on.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I would say so far I've enjoyed the couple of boss fights I've fought, but I mean, the controls, they work, definitely. I've not had a problem with them at all. I've really been sort of locked in, and I haven't had to like stand up or do ridiculously exaggerated motions or anything like that. You know, it is subtle, even though it's channeling down the information into, you know, sort of eight directional swipes, really, isn't it? But, you know, that's definitely a lot more nuanced than your typical kind of Zelda combat. And I would say, you know, I don't know whether I had the same kind of acclimation period that you did, Neil. It just kind of clicked pretty quickly. I mean, there was a few things like you get used to the idea, like when you're attacking the little blobs on the ground, you know, like at first I was just kind of naturally just swishing from side to side, but of course, you know, you're not attacking them, you're just swishing over their heads, so you actually had to think, oh, I've actually got to swing down on them, they're beneath me, you know, just little things like that. I get that did maybe take a little while, but it was nothing irritating. It was like, oh yeah, you know, this is, you know, kind of how involved it is now. I was good with that.
Hey, I'm back. My Skype went not responding there for a minute, but I am returned.
It's live.
I mean, definitely with my early troubles with the controls, I mean, I don't really know what was going on, why I'm special in that regard. But I mean, my one, like the one crystal point that I remember is with bombs, where the bombs, you can either kind of shoot it like you would a basketball in Wii Sports Resort or bowl it like you would a bowling ball in Wii Sports Resort. And at first, I was not a fan of that. Going back to the demos that I've played, I never really enjoyed that. And in the early goings, when you first get access to the bombs, there's a couple of things where it's like you need to specifically bowl it or roll it in such a way. And like the first few instances of that, I was really, really frustrated. And then somewhere along like the next couple times, it just clicked and I loved it. And there's some use of that mechanic later on in the game that's just it's spectacular. It's
That's one of the things that intrigues me about some of what I've read, you know, and obviously it's a bit early for me to judge, but the idea that the items that you get early in the game continue to be used and actually in new applications throughout the course of the game, that is quite different from a number of Zelda games, and particularly, I think, from Twilight Princess, which it was very much sort of
specific items.
And I mean, I think it was done really well. I mean, I love, you know, how specific those dungeons were in a way, but it gave them the opportunity to be very sort of tight and focused in their design around a particular thing. But on the other hand, it kind of took any of the sense of surprise out of it in some ways, because you know, you knew it was going to be built around you know something you hadn't got yet, and then when you got it, you knew you were going to use the shit out of it, basically. So now, actually, I think as a follow-up to that, I think it's absolutely the right way to approach it, to have all these items continue to be used, and maybe you do a bit more creative thinking in that way. How are you going to use them?
One of the things that really sort of disappointed me was with the bomb throwing in particular, is that you really,
Maria,
really can't seem to do any
a girl named Maria. All right, Uncle Bob, $10 donation bonus.
God, guys, taking requests.
Good Lord. I just happened to notice
this
that.
This is a bad precedent to set.
$10 me. Donation bonus if someone right now sings a few lines of Tonight. Damn it, Tonight. Ah. All I can remember is Maria. Damn it.
Well, we are over $1,600 right now, so that means that we're past the 50% mark of our total donation goal.
Nice job,
and
guys.
We've crossed the threshold for the Radio Trivia segment for myself and TYP. TYP, of course, the Radio Trivia Master. He's going to be coordinating all that. So the next one up now that we've got to get up to 2,000 is the GameCube section. So that's going to be that you've got to get up to that because we've got Billy, a bunch of old faces from the PGC, even in 2000 days. That's how far we're going to be going back. So that's hundreds of dollars yet to go, but continue.
Yeah, I still have to echo with Carl as well that the real gem is for 2400, where we'll have people from 8-4 play with guys from Memcast.
Yeah.
So I'm super excited to listen to that.
I'm quite happy for people to shoot us up to that goal within the next hour. That's fine with me.
That way we can feel responsible.
Awesome.
But yeah, so going back to Zelda. After a little hiatus. But I mean, the thing with the items is that I did really like how you use them more than just in that dungeon. And it's almost to the point where when you get them, it's not as memorable, which might come off like it's a bad thing. As in, like, there's some items where, like, I mean, Andy was going through the game and he'd be like, you know, when do I get the next item? And I'm just like, I don't even remember, because you just kind of get them organically through it. It's not like, oh, in the sixth dungeon, you get that item. I honestly don't even remember which dungeon is which number, because it all just kind of flows organically as you go through the world.
I can hear you, Andy. I mean, about the point about flowing together is because one of the big things, you know, that's been talked about by Nintendo in their rhetoric and then, you know, in the reviews is how they've changed it so that some of the kind of overworld elements or the field, as Nintendo likes to say, the field sections outside of the dungeons are more like dungeons. And I've already seen that, definitely. I mean, the designs are definitely quite puzzle-driven, almost maze-like at times. And what you've got is some of that kind of backwards-forwards kind of level design that I like to see in a Metroid game, but in a very dense way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's all sorts of, like, okay, well, now I can push this log so I can just, you know, take a shortcut that eliminates all that stuff I just did climbing up vines or whatever, you know, and that'll play out many times in just a relatively small kind of area until it becomes, you know, you can get to any part of it very quickly and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But one thing I was thinking about that played over the course of the entire game, and there are, I understand already, some changes in that structure as it goes on, but does it ever feel samey? I mean, does it feel like you just do? I mean, I love the puzzle solving, so I don't think this would be a problem for me. But
what do you mean by samey?
Well, in terms of, like, you constantly solving puzzles, does it, you know, even if there might be different kinds of puzzles from, like, the field to the dungeon, does it feel like you don't get the same sort of change of pace that you would have got in other Zelda games?
No, because it does do a good job of offering up that change of pace, I felt. Even when I was kind of, you know, going through the game in a quick way, which, you know, I didn't go as side quest heavy as I probably would have if, you know, I got this game on Sunday and just kind of took my polite stroll through it.
Yeah.
But I mean, even still, like, there weren't times where I'm just like, oh, great, it's another puzzle. The only thing that seemed a little repetitious throughout it is that there are a lot of fetch quests where it's just like, well, I would give you this to progress the story, but you need to go and collect these 20 things.
That's what it felt samey to me, was every time there was any sort of a bottleneck in the story, it was because you had to collect the four pieces of something to complete the something, which was only a fourth of the main thing you're looking for.
Yeah, but I mean, I've already had one instance of that, but I would contrast that with, say, for instance, collecting Tears of Light as the wolf in, you know, Twilight Princess. Where,
yeah, but
you know,
it's a much bigger part of Skyward Sword. You're doing it all the time. You're looking
I mean, the way I would contrast it, at least my experience of it so far, I'm limited, and see whether you know what you think about this, is that in Twilight Princess, when you're doing those bits early in the game, it was a bit just sort of scavenger hunty. It was kind of like, well, you know, you're pretty much just going to go everywhere in a particular area, with this Kakariko Gorge or whatever. You're just going to go just about everywhere, and then you'll find the 15. What I've had so far is a bit more deliberate. In terms of there's a kind of very kind of you are kind of searching them out with that whole dousing technique, for instance. Like at one point you're searching out a bunch of objects, but in reality you're kind of just being led along a path. Which if you do a number of specific things along the way, you bomb this thing, you create a bridge, you do that. You know, it's actually not as scavenger hunty as it appears in theory. I mean, that's kind of what I've thought of the one example I've played so far. How do you think that, you know, is it scavenger hunter later on or what?
I mean, with the dousing stuff, which I guess in the first area where you're introduced to it, I hated it because I just felt it's like, oh, great, I need to go find this stuff. But just walking around
the problem is that the map
view.
Is way too dense for that to work because getting like a very specific direction doesn't help you unless you have some sort of a guide to the path there. Which of course is the puzzle you're trying to solve is how do you get there? But the dowsing it just felt like it got in the way more than anything else. Although I
had a kind of zen moment in the second area where it wanted you to douse again, and I was just like, wait a minute, I can just explore the area, and if I get really stuck, then I'll use dowsing. And once I kind of used it like that, it didn't really bother me anymore because because for some people they can use it as a crutch and use it constantly, and for those people dousing might not bother them as much. But I guess for people that are more used to the Zelda exploration aspect or just, you know, game exploration in general, you can just kind of ignore it and go explore the area because you'll probably find stuff the same way. I mean, if you're like, oh, where's that last, you know, Baphomedad that I need to find, like, use dowsing and find out in the area where it was, and you can even set beacons to go like, all right, I'm pointing in that direction, bring up the map. Okay, I can go put a beacon. It's probably over in that area.
Yeah, that I like that actually, because sometimes it can be – you haven't got like a mini map on screen at the same time anymore, unless there's some weird way to bring one up. So like sometimes you wouldn't want to be kind of constantly pausing to have a look at the map and see like, am I facing in the right direction? Because like, so these are dense – already, obviously, dense areas is kind of easy to lose your bearings momentarily. But if you've just got that you know, you set the beacon on the map, and then you've just got this blue column of light that shoots out, you see, that's a nice way to reestablish your bearings quite quickly. But I mean, even just
the map beacons replace the mini map more or less. I think those are really handy.
Yeah, I could see that, and I mean, for me, with that first bit of that dousing situation with the you're trying to fight, you're finding things that are buried. It's like, I honestly thought it was just not helpful a lot of the time, you know, until I got to a point where it's like, okay, this seems like the kind of point where it would be. Now let's look and confirm, rather than, okay, let me just pace around really, because it's so vast. There's this huge area, and it's like,
and
you
it's
know,
you're on
the top of the hill, and like, I mean, Andy's absolutely right. It does not work in terms of like, okay, I'm getting closer, like some sort of, you know, like you're sweeping for mines or something. It really does not work that way.
You said, Greg, you said you're about two or three dungeons through the game so far?
Yeah, I'm two dungeons plus. I'm sort of into the next kind of field dungeon bit,
the quote-unquote third area?
Yeah, I guess. Which it already looks pretty interesting.
The third area of that game I love. It's wonderful.
I'm curious what you think of the dungeon design as compared to something like Twilight Princess, because what I felt was that I was really surprised to find that the dungeons, while still being tricky and certainly taking some time to go through, they're much simpler in design than the dungeons in, say, Twilight Princess. They're not nearly as intricate. They're not as massively sprawling. Like, I think the first dungeon in Twilight Princess is like three or four different levels, and it's just huge and sprawling. I think it took a while to get to a dungeon in Skyward Sword that had more than one level.
Really? Yeah. I mean, I guess I'd noticed there weren't two complex at this point, at least, you know, sort of architecturally they were too complex, but you know, it's the first couple. I mean, they might not be, you know, going for, I mean, you go back to Ocarina, I mean, those first couple of dungeons are pretty simple, so you know, they might just be kind of easing you in, but really over the course of the game you don't think it goes to the level of intricacy of Twilight.
I think what kind of makes it that is that because you have that kind of like pre-dungeon area that's almost like a dungeon. That when you do get into the dungeon, they're a lot more focused. And I thought that was better. And I'm trying to think. I don't know. Like, I mean, Andy, you've gone through it more recently than I have. But there's maybe one, maybe two dungeons that are actually two or three floors or something.
Yeah, there's not.
But I don't really feel like the other ones are lacking because
no, I don't either.
Three floors.
Yeah, the second dungeon in particular, there was a spot where I had to I had to find a way through, and I was really stuck there. I had to push a button on two sides of a bridge, and
oh yeah, I just did this.
Yeah, yeah, I know. And I'm not gonna get too specific. I'm trying to stay as vague as I can while still like talking about it. I had a really hard time trying to figure out how to get to the other side of that bridge. I think I spent more time in that dungeon than I spent in any of the dungeons since then, because I was just
really?
It
took me a little while as well, yeah, because it's very sort of circuitous, shall we say, the route that you end up taking to achieve that. But you know, I mean, no, I've enjoyed them so far, but
I really did too.
But I guess it does go to that point again of having, you know, if you're going to have these sort of this connective tissue, which is also quite puzzle centric, that perhaps they didn't feel the need to kind of ramp it up to some, you know, kind of obscene level of intricacy with the particular, you know, dungeons or whatever. I mean, I think I that's good with me. You know, I mean, I've not been a fan of, you know, having this connective tissue in a game, especially, you know, some like Spirit Tracks, where, you know, the dungeons are just absolutely fantastic in my view. But then
but then
the overworld is just so perfunctory and pointless, really. Just what did it, apart from the wonderful music, it really didn't bridge, you know, could get repetitive after a while riding around on those tracks.
The funny thing is, during Spirit Tracks, I would usually have the volume kind of low when I was in the dungeons, and then I'd go out into the overworld and just blast it, because it's the only way that I could get through that without being like, oh my god, come on, why aren't I to the next area yet? And I really like Spirit Tracks. I think it's a great game. I think it's way better than Phantom Hourglass, but I mean, that overworld is pretty terrible.
Yeah, the overworld. Well, this the dungeons are better, and the overworld's even worse. That's what I would say. So, you know, but this, I feel, you know, for me, is definitely the kind of solution that I would want. I mean, you've got the, in terms of the sky, it seems to be like a sort of really streamlined version of the ocean from Wind Waker, you know, obviously it's just a big open expanse. There's not much to it, but then there's like maybe a few little areas where you might get treasure. And it's so, you know, like with the goddess cubes, whether you strike them and it just sends a treasure chest up, you know, that's kind of similar to finding a treasure chart and then going to uncover it on the seafloor in Wind Waker. But it just all happens a lot quicker, you know, because it's relatively smaller, and you know, the way you could zip around on the bird and all that, it just feels very instant. So you've got some of that kind of thing that happened in Wind Waker, but just on a sort of a smaller scale, and there's less, you know, let me just set course and go and make a sandwich kind of thing. You know, there's none of that. And then you enjoy the stuff on the surface. Has been really good so far. But I'm wondering now, obviously this is where we get into specifics, is a bit tricky, but you know, obviously, there's this sort of rhythm at the moment of, you know, you have the bit outside that's sort of puzzle-like, and then the bit inside that's a bit puzzle-like. But how, I'm for sure people, even if they've been avoiding spoilers for the most part, probably would have heard about the Silent Realm, because it was demoed by Nintendo.
E3 last year.
So, I mean, how do things, without getting too specific, how do things like that kind of change up the rhythm? Does it enhance it, improve it, just make it different? What would you say?
All right. Well, first off, when I saw that at E3 last year, I was just like, oh, crap. They're basically taking everything that I didn't like about past games and putting it into it. But in practice, I love the Silent Realm, because what it does is how we were talking about how, you know, you're going to these environments and you're exploring the area, you know, maybe using dowsing, maybe not, and kind of, you know, finding, I mean, it's a scavenger hunt. What this is that it's basically, I mean, it is a scavenger hunt, but it's very focused and intense. So it's kind of like a mixture of, like, you know, the stuff with the Temple of the Ocean King and Phantom Hourglass, with, you know, collecting the tears, the Twilight Tears as the wolf. But how those are kind of divisive, this I don't really think is. Because they basically boiled it down to the essence of the good parts of both of those, which is kind of that exploration of the environment and that, you know, that I guess that fear that something might be coming up behind you. I know I've detailed this in the forum somewhere, so if you really want to know about it, it's either in the review thread or the Skyward Sword thread that we have in the forums, nintendoworldreport.com/forums. But, I mean, I really think it works, and I think what works best is, unlike the Twilight Princess, the Twilight Tier stuff, you aren't going to these areas for the first time when you do the Silent Realm. You have already gone to these areas maybe multiple times by the time you do them.
Yeah.
So it's very, so it's quite literally a change up. You know, you go into and they're putting a new spin on something. Oh yeah.
I think it's not a very big part of the game. You only do it like a handful of times, and I never found any of them particularly challenging. I think the most I had to attempt a Silent Realm section of the game was maybe three times. When you find them, they get put on your map so that if you don't complete it successfully, you can go back to it quickly. Even if you hated the Silent Realm bits, they're not so prevalent in the game that it would damage my opinion of the game.
But on the other hand, do you think they add something to it? Is that something?
Absolutely, I do. I think
they do.
I think it breaks up the – yeah, I think you're right about the game does kind of run the risk of feeling a little bit samey in terms of you're constantly, you know, just trying to find the four pieces of the so-and-so in the woods or whatever. And this is it's a definite, very decisive change of gameplay style at a time when the game could probably use a little bit of a change up.
Yeah, but I guess you've always got what seems to be like a kind of bunch of potential side questy kind of stuff related to people in the Skyloft.
It is kind of Majora's Mask-esque in that regard. There's even some side quests that, I mean, I'm not as familiar with Majora's Mask, but I was like, I came across a side quest in this game. I was just like, that seems really familiar. And then I saw someone mention about the Majora's Mask side quest and it reminded me of on Twitter. I was just like, oh man, they are kind of calling back to that. And it's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, I'm all in favor of that, but it remains like you kind of already suggested in terms of this sort of burning through it for review. It's obviously that was central.
Hey folks, we hit one of those aforementioned technical snags here and lost the live stream for a moment, but we'll be right back to answer your questions on Skyward Sword. So here we are.
We're back.
We're back.
Yay! And we are currently at 1640. We are 51%, and we are beginning our way to the next segment, which is the GameCube one, which should be awesome.
Yeah.
And now we're going to go into questions, and Greg, I believe you have.
Yeah, we've got a few queued up here. I guess the flow was probably interrupted by that downtime there, but I've got a few queued up, so let's have a look at some. And they want the Johnny. I'm going to be preferential treatment here. This is one question. Sort of spoiler, but not really. Does your sword look cooler and become more powerful throughout the game, like in Wind Waker?
Yes.
I kind of assumed it would, given the story, but...
The story is that you're making the Master Sword, so yes.
there's actually a mini game that you can play on one of the floating islands that you will do better at the more powerful your sword gets. So you can kind of come back to it as the game progresses and try your luck again and see if you can get a higher score, which is great.
And the funny thing is that the guy will even make comments about how, like, well, you know, if your sword was better, you'd do better, but you just can't do that good right now.
Yeah.
Oh, well, the next one I wanted to pick through here is Leeway asks, I've been hearing the world / overworld can feel disconnected, confined, and linear compared to previous Zeldas. How have you guys found exploration in the world so far?
Well, to be fair, how open are previous Zeldas? Okay, Wind Waker, you have a lot of freedom with where you can go once you get the boat, but Twilight Princess wasn't exactly all that open world. I mean,
Hyrule Field is just a big empty spot. And in Ocarina, all you have is Lon Lon Ranch in the middle there.
So, I mean, yeah, it's fairly linear. I mean, you can the sky area is pretty open from the beginning. You can go look around there, like, you know, as to your heart's content. But once you get down into the actual, like, gameplay world where you're going to be doing most of your exploring and finding cool items and stuff, it is pretty linear. And I think that's not that different from at least from Twilight Princess and probably other Zelda games that aren't like Link to the Past, basically, I think.
Yeah,
Link to the Past,
I mean,
linear. You can't go everywhere right away. You have to
I mean, you're really thinking of like the original Zelda for where you know you had the kind of freedom that some other games are offering. Maybe some people want that. I mean, I have to say I did just manage to finish Xenoblade before, you know, starting Skyward Sword, and I mean, I've done plenty of exploring. I'm quite content to just play a more structured, you know, kind of thing. I mean, you know, so the appeal of kind of roaming around and all that. I mean, you know, I understand it, I can appreciate it, but at the same time with Zelda, I'm quite happy to have it be a bit more focused and structured. So it's not a particular problem for me, at least so far. But I mean, I don't know, maybe it's a part of the game, you know, that some people might miss. I could see that personally.
Yeah, but I feel like that it wouldn't be missed because of Skyward Sword being like that. It would be missed because 3D Zelda do that.
I kind of feel like they've dropped the pretense a little bit, you know, and I don't really think that's a bad thing myself. So, but now we've got another question here that Carl's put. So for Tyrion Cubed, for now, the Skyloft region isn't offering much apart from fetch quests and a handful of floating islands. Does it get better later in the game?
Skyloft is not offering much besides fetch quests. And well, what Zelda Town does. Yeah. Well, okay, to be fair,
Skyloft is one of the best towns I've ever seen. I mean, it's that and Clock Town are really the top
Skyloft
two.
Skyloft doesn't have islands. Skyloft is a floating island. It is the central floating island in the sky. So
I think he might mean the entire sky.
Okay, so yeah, the sky in general is not nearly as explorable as something like the ocean in Wind Waker. That's unfortunate, but I think the flip side of that is everything below the sky is far, far more explorable than something like Wind Waker. As for Skyloft itself, like you mentioned, like there haven't been a lot of super impressive town areas in a Zelda game. I mean, the castle town in Twilight Princess looked bustling and it had a cool like look and feel to it, but there really wasn't that much to do in there. Mm-hmm. And same with in Clock Town in Majora's Mask had a lot of things to do, and it was the biggest town in a Zelda game to that point. But Skyloft blows Clock Town out of the water. There's just
but the other
so
thing
much
is
going on.
But in terms of the, sort of the substance, I think like with Majora's Mask, you've got that very particular thing of like everything is happening on a clock. Everything's planned out. So you could kind of have these situations where you're kind of interacting with the citizens of the town in a way that might not just be sort of fetch quest. I mean, it definitely is kind of fetch questy or, you know, talking to the right person or this kind
Let's
of thing.
Let's not kid ourselves. Zelda side quests are fetch quests. That's the way it's always been.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm fine with that being the kind of thing that you could dip into at your leisure. Yeah. I mean, that's where I would have that kind of thing. And it does seem like
is there anything in Skyloft that's like going to blow your mind because you haven't seen it before in a Zelda game? No, probably not. But it's still really great.
There is the whole like going up there to kind of upgrade your gear and all that kind of stuff.
Talked about that at all. Like the way you upgrade your gear and the inventory management. This is the first Zelda game that's ever had inventory management and it works beautifully.
Yep.
The way you have to – well, you find treasure down below to upgrade your stuff, but you can only carry – aside from your weapon items, you have these other items, these adventure pouch items like your bottles, your shield. You can get these various like enhancement medals. Like if you're wearing a medal, you get an extra heart piece. If you're wearing a medal, you'll find treasure more easily. I think there's probably one for stamina, but I haven't found it. And you have to balance your inventory and carry as many of those things as you feel like is appropriate. And even better, when you go down to an area, you can ask your little like guide, this game's version of Navi. You can ask your guide, how well am I suited to this area based on what I have in my adventure pouch? And that's great. It'll say your adventure pouch is survival focused. It is 85% suited to your current environment.
Although she does just throw out random percentages, I feel. It's like, I have an 80% chance that this is where we're going next. It's like, really? Like, that dude just telling me that this is where we got to go next wasn't enough of a confirmation?
Yeah, but she's clearly analyzing the things you have on you and the environment and giving you some sort of an analysis that says, well, okay, you're in a place where everyone uses electrical attacks, but you have a shield that can't block electricity. So you didn't plan well. Maybe you should go back and try again. You'll have to. But maybe you should.
Yeah, I mean, I have not really got into the whole upgrading cycle yet. I mean, it seems really cool. Was there ever a time where it kind of affected how you like? I'll kill a few more of this enemy to try and get a drop, or you know, I mean, did it?
I mean, it does have this stuff. When you get a certain weapon, you can kind of do that same thing in Wind Waker where you would be able to like kind of steal the medals or whatever off of moblins or bokoblins.
Yeah, the necklace they had and all that.
Yeah, you can do that and kind of take stuff that way. And then you do get a point later in the game where you can kind of look for specific items that you need. Yeah. And at least like they'll tell you where this would be. Like if you go to upgrade something and you've only got two out of the three required, it'll be like, well, if you go to this area, I think you'd find more of it there, which is cool. The one thing that's kind of, I guess, jerkish about that is that if you upgrade a shield and that shield breaks, too bad, you got to start all over. I was kind of like, I almost did it. I was like, well, I upgraded the shield and I'll be pretty bummed if it's dead forever, but I just want to test this. And sure enough, I broke it and I was screwed. I had to go buy a shield and start over.
I guess if you like going to stress test the thing, you probably aren't going to break it.
I think to answer your question, Greg, I would have spent more time on the upgrading and crafting system if I had more time with the game. Honestly.
Sure, yeah, you were on a clock as well. That's the thing.
The baby clock.
I loved that part of the game, and I wish I had more time to explore it and to see what effects I would get from upgrading my gear. I think I've upgraded my quiver, I've upgraded my slingshot, I've upgraded my shield, I hope this isn't too spoilery. There is a shield in the game where breaking and damaging your shield is less of a concern. It's not a concern, but it's less of a concern. And I upgraded that shield because I thought it was a good shield to upgrade. Because I figured I would have it for longer.
The upgrades that you do for items, or I guess weapons, are cool because it's not stuff that's necessary, but it actually, you know, they're for the most part, they are cool upgrades that, you know, make those weapons better.
Even the way this game does money, I really like, because you start off with a wallet that can hold 300 rupees, and you don't
have to go track down. You normally hit like 99 right away, don't you?
In previous Zelda games, you have to go find the bigger wallet or something, or unlock it by collecting stuff. And this game, you just buy another wallet, and you can buy as many wallets as the game will sell you.
Yeah.
And then you can carry more money because you have another wallet on you. It's great. I like that a lot better.
Yeah, that is better, definitely. We've got another question here. This is
matters in this game.
This is from MattX22. It says, where do you feel that with the release of Skyward Sword and its very intuitive motion gameplay, will Skyward Sword take Zelda games in the future? So, I mean, it's interesting because, Neil, you mentioned that you don't know whether you want to go back, you know, to...
Yeah, like, I was actually thinking of... Because I started replaying Twilight Princess and finally got through the terrible 3-day opening. And I was thinking, like, oh, after Skyward Sword, maybe I'll go back and play that. And I just thought about it after beating Skyward Sword, and I sent it over to Andy. I don't really want to go back and play Twilight Princess because as far as motion controls go in Zelda game, like, this nailed it. Like, I don't really want anything else. I just want this. I want more of this. Obviously, we're probably not going to get that for a while as Anuma has,
here's the 100%
confirmed that they're making a new Zelda game for 3DS, which I guess that would be the next one.
But that's the thing. You've got 3DS and then you've got Wii U as well. Even on the console, we're not thinking it's going to be another Wii Motion Plus centric Zelda that just takes it even further or something. You know, this probably will be it for this kind of gameplay. I mean, does that make you sad or do you think they might actually continue it one day?
Yeah, see, that's it. Is that this game is so inherently tied to the system that it's on because for all intents and purposes, is the game that this system was built for. This is the game that this system has been leading up to for better part of 6 years. And so, with that said, I don't really know. It's hard to tell what the future means for Zelda because I don't really know what the future means for what Nintendo is going to do next.
The Wii U is still kind of ill-defined at this point, so it's a little difficult. But a franchise of Zelda's prominence. If you have something on Wii U, yes, it will still support the Wii Remote, but we do not expect that it would forego the unique features of the tablet controller.
Right.
To have a sequel to Skyward, so a relatively straight sequel. You know, it's going to have to try and sort of sell you on the unique features of the system with the game design, and that will mean that it probably will go in quite a different direction, which kind of breaks the kind of steady progression that you've kind of had throughout.
I will say that
these albums.
You know, they spent so much time developing the Motion Plus control system for this game that they may want to just reuse that development time with another title just to recoup the money they spent, you know, researching it.
I mean,
with
I almost
time,
hope
they reuse the engine for Majora's Mask, so.
I mean, I almost hope that they, you know, take these kind of Motion Plus controls that they developed and, you know, got with Wii Sports Resort and maybe even take it to a different franchise. I think that'd be kind of cool. Because I feel like with Zelda, the next big console Zelda that we game or that we get, you know, unless they go the Super Mario Galaxy 2 route, which I don't think they will do considering Skyward Sword took 5 years to make and they're probably moving on.
At this stage in the cycle,
or even make a Super Mario Galaxy 2-esque sequel for like early on in Wii U. I think that's a minor possibility, but I don't think it'll happen. I mean, I think that we're not going to see a Zelda game on Wii U for probably 3 or 4 years, because we did get Skyward Sword right now. I mean, I think we'll see a 3DS game probably in like 2 years. Maybe we'll get Majora's Mask 3DS, and then I look forward to seeing whatever Nintendo figures out to do with Wii U on Zelda because, I mean, yeah, I have a little bit of retroactive dislike for Twilight Princess, but they've never really let me down with a Zelda game. At least whenever they come out, I always enjoy them a lot. So
I think you guys are insane. I think Twilight Princess is an amazing game.
I'm very fond of Twilight Princess.
I don't think it's bad. There are certain parts of that game that leave a bad taste in my mouth.
Some of it is, you know, you're more tolerant of certain things when you're playing it at the beginning of a life cycle, or there maybe there's not much else to play, or just because of the impact of a new Zelda game. I mean, you will be more forgiving when you try to replay it. So yeah, that minimizes some of the. But I played through it 3 times, as I mentioned on last episode of Final Fantasy. I'm fine with it. I enjoy that game. It did. The good certainly outweighs the bad quite convincingly.
When I say that I have a dislike for Twilight Princess, it's
all relative.
It's like the whole thing of like how, you know, bad Simpsons episodes are still or bad Simpsons episode were still better than most of TV. Like that's kind of what I mean by that. Is in like, you know, just because it's my least favorite 3D Zelda game doesn't mean it wouldn't be in like a list of like my top 50 games of all time. It's just that
Well, Neil, you made the comment, Neil, that you thought about maybe going back to Twilight Princess after you sent me Skyward Sword, but you didn't think you could go back to it. I think that's actually exactly what I'm going to do once I mail Skyward Sword back, is I'm going to pull up Twilight Princess and keep going through that, because I started replaying it as well about 2 months ago, and I got through, I think, to the Water Temple and then kind of lost momentum. But I've been kind of loving this game so much that I don't want to give up the Zelda when I'm done with it, so I may go back to Twilight Princess again.
Yeah, I mean, my thing with Twilight Princess is that I'm currently in the second dungeon there, so I don't have to replay the first three days, which is really, it was my big stumbling block in that game for a while. And it is, I was talking to some friends about it, and the later dungeons, like, I want to get to there. It's just that I have time before I get to there, which...
You should copy your save file and just from now on always start from that save file.
That's my plan. I actually have already done that, where, I mean, now that I can have worked... Because that's what really kills me, is that... I mean, I get why it was done for the sake of the Wii and everything, but those first 3 days, like, it takes you so long to get somewhere in Twilight Princess. But
I don't think it's that bad. I think it's not that bad.
I do think this Skyward Sword gets off to a bit of a quicker start.
Definitely does.
We've got more questions to get to before the end of the hour. So Kilimanjaro writes, I've played up to the second dungeon so far, only a few of the songs have been orchestrated. Yeah, I still think that a lot of the non-orchestrated music is good. What are your thoughts on the soundtrack? And on a related note, was all the first people made about the orchestra really necessary? I like orchestrated music, but did people forget it's still possible to make good music with synth?
I like that question, and I agree with you that, you know, it's cool that it's orchestrated, but it doesn't have to be for it to be good music. I love the Ballad of the Goddess also, like the main theme from this. Yeah. I think it's great. One of the better Zelda songs.
It's very good, yeah. Which is the backwards Zelda lullaby, isn't it? That's what that's where it comes from. But I mean, it's what I've seen. I'm pretty much the same point there. But, you know, I expected it to be a mix. I mean, things is such a huge game that, you know, I didn't expect that they'd have, you know, fully. Even Mario Galaxy has plenty of synth music in it. You know, and I certainly didn't expect a game of Zelda scope to be, you know, a constantly orchestral score.
The traditional Zelda chime when you solve a puzzle, is orchestrated with like a harp or some sort of a stringed instrument, and it's really great.
I think, you know, I mean, there's no doubt you can achieve very good things with synth if you do it right.
You know, and even with what we would now consider to be sort of relatively crude, synth, like 8-bit especially, or even 16-bit, Chrono Trigger, and people love that music, all that kind of stuff. But I mean, I think with Zelda, when they've gone in a more, as I mentioned, like with the concert, but they've gone in a more cinematic direction. Sometimes they've had songs which clearly were written and intended to have the bombast of an orchestra, but it doesn't have one. You think of like final boss fights and stuff like that, and that's what I'm really looking forward to, because I think in this case it's going to add a lot of punch to that sort of stuff. The impact is really going to hit, I think, when you've got that. It just, there's something far more kind of impactful about it than when you've got the full range of instruments. So I mean, is there any particular moments in the game that you guys would point to where you felt that?
Yeah, but I can't talk about them.
Yeah, I know that. I just wanted to sort of confirm suspicions that there would be those.
I don't know. That's
what I really think. It's just those particular kinds of situations where it could really augment. It doesn't have to be.
I'm not really sure what fuss there was about the orchestra. I mean, I think it's a good idea for a game like Zelda to have orchestrated music. I think it sounds great. And yeah, it doesn't all have to be orchestrated, but I think this is exactly the kind of game that should have it.
Yeah, I mean, and it does have to be all, and I do like having kind of dynamic kind of music, as though you see that quite early on in the bazaar in Skyloft, where it sort of changes.
God, it's so cool.
It's like you pretty much like take a step from one stall to the next, and the music completely changes. Like, it's really
cool. And I also like how all the item stuff is in one area, or like all the shops are in one area, as opposed to having to go in and out of multiple houses.
That's true. That is very nice. It's so streamlined in that way. So, I'm quite pleased with that. But, I mean, I think it's something, the orchestra music was something that a lot of people wanted. I wanted it. I'm glad we've got it. But, it's not some sort of, like, supremacist thing where we have to have it for everything. I mean, there are points where the sort of dynamic synthesized music, especially some of the more kind of whimsical moments, like in the town or whatever, could definitely work. It's the grandeur that I'm looking for. And the select moments. Okay, well, we've got a few more questions here. Another musical-related one from Tyrion again. It says, I've just got the harp, and I don't really like the way you play it. What do you think about the musical instrument they chose for the game?
I feel like they picked it just because they were like, it's a Zelda game. We're supposed to have a musical instrument, right? Right?
No, I don't like the harp either. I think the harp is hard to play. And I actually wrote a blog post about this. I had a lot of trouble with the harp when I first started the game. And actually what I found, if you haven't read my blog post, here's a quick summary for you. So when you're using the pointer in the game uses either the infrared or the motion plus, depending on, I think, just – it tries to use both, I think. And you'll find that, you can tell immediately that it's not the same as other Wii games because the pointer moves a little slower and you can recenter the pointer no matter what you're looking at. So, I mean, you can face the wall and still use the pointer, and it uses the motion plus just fine. What I found was that some of the gesture-based controls, like the harp specifically, I was getting infrared interference from the sunlight.
Is it infrared interference, though? I mean, because I didn't think it used the sensor bar.
Well, here's how I tested it. I covered the tip of the Wii Remote with my finger, and the problems went away instantly.
Ah, that's really interesting. Because I just assumed this purely just for the fact that, when you're doing the menu stuff, it's like the pointer's in treacle compared to other games. It just, it's so kind of slow. It feels like it's gesture-based pointing,
exactly.
If you like. And so I just assumed that it wasn't really in play.
I had a couple of times in the game where the pointer was freaking out on me, like it would if I had interference with the IR. And so I covered the tip of my Wii Remote, and I had no problems anymore. So I think there's a little bit of IR interference potential, and that gave me a real problem with the harp. Now, I'm not sure if he's mentioning he doesn't like what they chose in the game for you to play, because basically you just move your arm back and forth. There's no notes like you have on the ocarina, or if he's mentioning that it's actually hard to use, which is what I found.
The funny thing is that I like about the harp, I mean, it's funny, not that it's good, but it's just kind of that whole culmination of everything on Wii, whereas the harp is Wii music.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's so many bits of just basically like every game that Nintendo had a hand in on the Wii, there's some small part of it in Skyward Sword, which I think is really cool. I mean, it does kind of give that like whole like, like the entire system was building to this game, which I don't really know if there's another console that I can think of that did that.
No, that is going to be a good place to leave our discussion here as we're coming up on the hour. And so just give a quick update. We are now approaching $1,700. So we're still some, you know, 300 away from our next donation goal, but we're making good progress. And thanks to Neil and Andy, of course, for being our resident Zelda experts here.
Happy to be here.
I
honestly cannot wait for everyone else to play this game so we can all talk about it and argue stuff like that. Because I sincerely like adore this game. It's one of the I think it's my favorite 3D Zelda game, and I hate speaking in hyperbole like that, especially that it's, you know, it's not even freaking out yet. But I mean, I really, really liked it, and I really enjoyed Twilight Princess when I first played it too, but not in the same way that I enjoyed Skyward Sword.
I think, and I also am not one to engage in hyperbole for the most part, but if I compare this directly to every other 3D Zelda game, the only one I have trouble putting it above is Majora's Mask, because I love Majora's Mask. But if you're among those that are crazy and don't like Majora's Mask, you won't have that problem.
I mean, it's like all the other Zelda games, or at least the 3D Zelda games, kind of do that good thing of like iterating, but then making new stuff where it's kind of like, you know, that part didn't really work too well in that game, but we're going to make it better in the next one. And that game is going to be even better. So I can't wait for the next Zelda game.
We're sure as hell can.
5 years from now.
We got to make the transition now, guys. So thanks again. We got to let you go. Okay. If our responsible person is going to make the switch, we are moving on to the listener call-in bonanza now.
Yes.
So I am
going to make a note because Shaman just brought it up. It has been 86 days in North America since there's been a virtual console release, and even more in Europe. But
far more, actually.
Yeah, we might get an online Street Fighter, but I mean, people are like, "Oh, that's coming out this week." No, it's not. We're not going to get another virtual console game.
I'm glad you brought that up too. You know, I'm the virtual console guy, Neil. So, but it seems like probably that will end before the year. I certainly hope so.
I hope so. All right. Yeah, I will be back on for the Game of the Year stuff. I look forward to listening to the rest of the show. Bye, everybody.
The great Zelda segment for the past hour, I can say that the audio actually sounds better on the stream than it does over Skype. So we're doing something right. Okay, so who have we got on here now? Is John back?
Yes, John is back.
Hey, John.
Johnny.
James, are you going to be talking for this, or are you just running?
Yes.
I wasn't clear from the way we had the schedule written out. Good. So we've got the whole RFN crew here. Greg, are you're staying on, right?
Oh, I'm in.
Oh, Greg's a trooper. This is his third hour in a row.
I'm normally editing the show for 8 hours straight on a Saturday. You think this is tough?
This is vacation for Greg. And TYP's hosting the call. And guess what? We've got another person here. Our special guest for the call-in segment is our old friend Jeff Callis.
Well, hello. Let's hope the audio is working and you can hear me.
I can hear you. Yes, sir.
You can.
Yay, so, tech working on the first time.
I know. Well, we've done extensive testing, so we feel pretty confident.
Don't say it.
No, it's like I told TYP before, you know, he was apologizing for the stream cutting out. And I said, look, we prevent as much as we can, but we can't prevent everything. So what we can't prevent, we will fix quickly and easily. And that's how it's going to go. It's a live show. Things go wrong, and when they do, we fix them, and we move forward with the show. And it's gone pretty well so far, I think. So, Jeff, thank you very much for being here. Everyone, you might remember Jeff's voice or his name from last year's show when he joined us for a little while. Jeff works for Penny Arcade, so he's our official charity representative here.
Yeah, I guess I'm not an official Child's Play employee, but I am more than willing to stand in and I guess talk about whatever you guys need me to talk about.
Hey, you probably have a lot more fun in your job than the Child's Play people.
I know they're busy. So we just hired someone to do it. We had one person doing it full time, and for those of you that watch Penny Arcade TV, you may have seen last season we actually hired a new person to do a lot of the full-time year-round, Jamie. Unfortunately, she's super busy with another group that's doing wonderful things for Child's Play, the Desert Bus Guys.
I love Desert Bus. When this show is over, you should go watch Desert Bus because it's really funny. And it's spend all your money on us. Right. Empty your pocketbook for this event, but then go over to Desert Bus and just enjoy it because it's great. And they'll probably be going all weekend long. Those guys are psychotic, but they're also – they're like professional comedians, and they have all this crazy equipment and everything. So – it's a little bit different.
That's kind of gotten big on them. I think part of them looks forward to it, and part of them dreads it every year because they're just they play the worst game ever created for so long.
Yes. All right, so we'll continue chatting for a sec while we get everyone lined up. But here are the instructions from Carl on how to call in, because this is the listener call-in, listener mail call-in bonanza segment of the show. For the next hour, we're going to focus on taking your calls because we've had so much fun doing it the past couple times we did a live show. So here are the instructions. Turn on Skype. If you don't have Skype, download it. It's free. It's pretty easy to use. It's spelled Skype. If you've never used it before, it's free. Install that. Get it set up. Go through the setup and make sure your headset or your microphone is working properly. The other thing I have to ask is that when you call in, please pause the audio stream, because otherwise it will confuse the hell out of you because you'll hear everything twice with a delay. And you don't want that. So pause the audio stream on the website temporarily and just speak to us directly only over Skype, okay? So the instructions are: turn on Skype, send a message to carl.castaneda. That is carl.castaneda. We will post that in the chat room if you don't want to try to spell it from my verbalization there. When you send him a message, please include your question so that he can sort of prioritize. I just heard a Skype noise. Is that bad?
Someone left the chat. It's fine.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's fine.
Okay. Get out.
When you message Carl on Skype to tell him that you want to call into the show, include a question, and that way he can prep us and we kind of know what's going on here. Okay. And from there, he will bring you into the chat when it's your turn, and we will call you in. And then when you're done, we will boot you out and move to the next person. So that's how it goes. There's no time limit here. We'll just talk to you for a few minutes. You can ask us a question. We might ask you some questions, and we'll have a good time here. And by the way, Jeff Callis used to work at Nintendo, so you can ask him a question too.
Yeah, I'll see what I'm legally okay with answering still, even all these years later.
Right. Yeah, actually, we wanted to get Dylan Cuthbert on the show. And I asked him, and he said that he would love to, but he literally cannot say the word Nintendo in public without having a Nintendo PR person there. So we felt it was highly likely that we would be able to get a PR person to be on the show with him for this event. Just past experience. So
my client cannot answer that question, Johnny. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Dylan's a great guy, and I've known him for a long time. I'm sure you know him, Jeff. And love to have him on the show, but it's just, unfortunately, with Nintendo's legal policies, it's not possible.
Yeah.
He could just say Schmendo. Schmendo.
There we go.
He'll still come down and slap your hands and dock you pay.
Yep.
Okay, so I believe we have the first person sort of kind of lined up, right, Carl? Yep. I'm giving the word to bring Tyrion on here.
Make it silent.
Silent call out to the producer.
So. Okay, so if anyone's not clear on the instructions, just post in the chat room, and we'll help you out. Carl will help you out, or one of our other lovely staff people who are hanging out in the chat room will help you clear it up.
Hello, Scott. Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
It works. Yes.
Perfect. Hello, Terry.
That's the first thing. Hi, I'm fine. It's so great to be here.
Now, remember again, that you've called in before. Can you remind us where you're calling from?
Absolutely. My name is Luca, and I call from Italy. And I was the very first call-in on your on a live show.
Nice.
Nice.
Well, very happy to have you back, sir.
Now comes from a place that could be described as the Dominion of Super Mario due to the change of due to Silvio Berlusconi's demise.
Oh, Jesus. Thank God that's over, but let's not go there.
Very wise, very wise.
Yeah, and I have already done my Mario impression last time, so we're all covered.
Can you do your Mario impression in 3D?
Oh, God, I don't have a good microphone. I don't know
the
if it works.
The answer is no, can't, because we're using mono stream for this.
it works really, really well. The streaming audio quality is really high, and it's really good.
That's great. Yeah, we worked hard on that, and James and TYP have done a great job of setting everything up. So, Tyrion, did you have a question for us?
Indeed. I'm playing Skyward Sword, and despite some problems, like the constant need to recenter the curse and other things we were discussing before, I realized that Motion Plus controls really could work and really could have been used much more in this generation to enhance games in a good way. And I was wondering, do you think we will see more Motion Plus control games and with the next console, with the Wii U, since Wiimotes and the Wiimote Plus, which is really nice to use, will apparently be used alongside the tablet controller?
Yes.
Yeah, I would think so, definitely.
And I tell you, one thing that I would really like to have, I mean, you know, I think having a separate nunchuck and remote works really well for Zelda because you're using it as a sword. So for some things, I think that's a really good setup. For other things, I think just being able to tilt your controller and having it being really accurate. You know, a lot of early Wii games had you hold the controller as an NES controller sideways and then had you tilt. And it worked okay, but it wasn't very sensitive sometimes, or sometimes it was difficult for the developer to sort of calibrate it to the thing. And usually, you know, like games like Excite Truck and Mario Kart, they had you only tilted in one axis, where really it could be used in all different directions, and you could really do very fine control over it. And I know Carl really likes a WiiWare game called, was it The Art of Balance? Yeah. Art of Balance. And it uses it sort of, I've tried the demo and I thought it was okay, but I think there's a lot of potential in games that do that, especially if you integrate the tilt function into a controller that has a full set of joysticks and buttons and shoulder triggers and everything. So for one thing, the Wii U tablet controller does. So it has Motion Plus built in, but it also has all the controls that you'd want. I think the other side of that is that I think, and I've said this sort of before, even for Wii, but I think for Wii U, it's especially important. Nintendo should make a controller that is basically the classic controller with Motion Plus built into it, so that you can use all the tilting and all the gesture stuff at the same time that you use all the buttons and everything. So it's a little bit like the PlayStation 6 axis, but way better, right? Because it'll be a better controller and it has much better motion technology in it than that does. So I think there's a lot of potential there, and it's yet another controller to a system that maybe already has too many kinds of controllers. But
yeah, but they're part of their business. They got to sell you something, haven't they? And it's definitely they've sold us the classic controller twice, but third time is what they would like. Because if you had the motion control built in, it would be good. And it also might be necessary from the point of view that if you're not going to have multiple tablet controllers at once, which they've kind of, you know, that's gone back and forth.
It sounds like at the most we might be able to use two at the same time.
Yeah, you might be able to use two, and then whether they'll actually sell them separately, or whether it'd be a case of somebody bringing theirs to a friend's house, or that's all up in the air. But the point is, say for instance, if we're talking four and all that kind of stuff, if you want to have a game
that's using the functionality that Johnny described in the tablet controller, but then you want other people to do that but still have the full complement of buttons, you kind of need that classic controller that's been enhanced with the, you know, the motion sets here, the Wii Motion Plus gyroscopic tech. So, you know, that product seems quite likely to happen for me.
Yeah. You know, and the other part about it, and of course, as part of that, you wouldn't have to have it connected to a Wii remote, right? So there'd be no cord at all, and it would have its own battery and its own infrared sensor could be built into the controller as well. I think it would be useful for a lot of things. The other aspect is the Wii U will not support GameCube controllers unless they have some kind of weird dongle with a wireless thing built in, you know, or something. I don't know. But I mean, we assume that because it doesn't play GameCube games, it also will not support GameCube controllers. And a lot of people use GameCube controllers on their Wiis, especially for Smash Brothers, but for other things as well. And if you think about it, not that many people own classic controllers. I truly believe that. I don't have the sales data for it, but I would guess that the vast majority of people who own a Wii console do not own a classic controller. They certainly don't own more than one. So I think this is an opportunity for Nintendo to improve that and then sell a bunch of them to people who didn't buy them before.
Yeah, I mean, also, you know, why reinvent the wheel? I mean, they've already sunk the money into that tech. So, and it seems like they're kind of setting up Wii U and Wii to sort of coexist, at least for a certain amount of time. And by that, I mean more so than just being on the market at the same time. There's definitely going to be, you know, a little bit of interplay between, you know, games being made for both of them and stuff like that.
Yeah, there are some marketing issues with whenever you release a new accessory or a new upgrade or whatever, because if you're creating a game that is specifically for that, you risk fractioning the audience, the potential audience that can buy that game, unless you include it as an add-on into the game. But then you're increasing your cost and reducing your profit for every game that you do that for. So
doing it at the console launch is the best time.
Yeah, console launch packed in, ideally, is because then you've maximized your potential people that can benefit from this accessory. Launching an accessory mid-console lifespan is extremely difficult. Right. And it wasn't even until, I want to say, the N64 that accessories were even viable. All of them had failed. Like, you think about the Light Gun Zapper and Rob the Robot and the Super Game
Super
Boy.
Super Scope.
Multi-tab.
They were all failures, for lack of a better term. Maybe moderate success would be generous. And it wasn't until, oddly, different colored controllers were the first accessory to actually sell enough to make it viable. And it's only within the last couple generations you're even seeing, you know, the crazy peripherals actually succeeding to a point.
Well, and Jeff, you know the secret of the success of Nintendo's ability to sell accessories on N64 is that it had four controller ports. So having different colored controllers was actually practical. I mean, it was useful, right? Because then you know whose is whose. So it actually really helped out a lot to have different colors.
Yeah, and if you think about it, if I remember correctly, and my brain may not be working here, the Rumble Pack, wasn't that originally packaged with the Star Fox for N64?
Star Fox 64, yes.
Yeah, like that's how they introduced it, is they had to pack it in, which obviously drastically reduced the amount of profit they're going to make on that particular game.
Yeah,
it's a tricky thing to do, and unless you've planned for it at launch, it's really hard to change focus midstream.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Well, it's time to move on to the next caller, Tyrion. But thank you very much for your question.
No, thank you, guys.
We love hearing from you.
Yeah, I'll talk to you next live show. I'm 3 for 3.
Great. Great. All right. Thanks, man.
Bye.
Bye bye. Okay, and I believe we have the next person coming in. And while we bring that person in, I believe we can announce that we have just reached $1,800. That is fantastic, everybody. Thank you so much. And we are now getting very close to unlocking the next segment of the show, which will be Memoirs of a GameCube. And let me set this out for you. Jeff Callis will be back for that, right, Jeff?
That's right. You got to we got to get that donation total up so I at least can come back for and give the inside dirt on. I've been thinking about some stories about when I was working during that process of transition from the N64 to the GameCube.
Yeah, and your stories when you were on RFN to talk about Geist were so good. I cannot wait to hear that.
I know. I wish I was on that segment. Oh.
It was fantastic. So in addition to Jeff, we're also going to have Billy Berghammer on there. Of course, Billy started Planet GameCube, so he might know a thing or two about it. I'll be on there, and we're going to have Jeff Cannata from Totally Rad Show and Weekend Confirmed. It's going to be awesome. He's like one of my heroes on podcasts. And we're going to have Rick Powers, the legend, the myth, the legend of Rick Powers.
Yep. Wow, I haven't talked to Rick in a long time. Although I've been keeping up with his Facebook shenanigans and his new marriage and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, so it's going to be awesome. And Rick is truly an expert on GameCube as well. So you will want to hear that. And if you haven't donated yet, please do so now. Or if you did donate before and you're able to donate more, please do so, because that will help us get there. And I think that segment is going to be very, very, very well worth hearing. So we have the next person on here, Miguel.
Hello.
Hi, Miguel.
Hello.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
You're awesome.
I first off wanted to say I really wanted to give you guys props. I love the show. You guys were the very first gaming podcast I've ever listened to back since April.
Wow, and, thank you.
Oh, yeah. I kind of found you guys on accident. I had gotten an iPhone. I had looked up the podcast and went on iTunes looking for gaming podcasts. I was like, oh, hey, Radio Free Nintendo. I was like, Nintendo. I love Nintendo. So I gave you guys a listen, and, you know, every Sunday I tune in, and I really appreciate what you guys do. You guys are great, and I just wanted to give you guys props.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we really have to give credit to Greg, because I think one of the keys is that when people randomly find the show, whatever first episode they listen to will determine whether they keep listening, right?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Greg is the main reason that the show is consistently good every week. I'll say 99.5% of the time, the show is consistently really good every time. And Greg, it really does a ton of work to make sure that happens.
Make sure we don't ruin it.
Yes. Yeah, we do our best to ruin it.
Despite our best
every week, we try.
Of course, every Sunday. I like the people who listen on Sunday. I hesitate to call them the real fans, but you know what I mean.
It's eagerly awaiting and like refreshing constantly to see when it pops.
Although in many ways it was the Sunday that was designed for people, if they were listening to it on their commute, they'd have it ready for Monday. But you know, if you can't even wait that long for it to take away from the monotony and drudgery of your commute, then you are a real fan.
Right. My weekend is too dire. I have to listen.
I just always look for that post just to see kind of how, like, I was there for the show, but I like to see how that translates to the post. In other words, I know what went on the show, what really went on. And, you know, Johnny or Greg generally just, you know, writes up the article and sums it up. And I'm like, okay, that's a good way to spin it.
It's always fun when I read the article and I see a glaring omission of something that happened to go, well, that got cut.
Yes.
I like the article, and then before Greg makes the show live, he edits the article to take out everything that I put in there that he extracted from the show.
Three or four John MMO segments have been lost. Very
definitely lost. Yeah. Don't worry. Okay. We'll bring them back in one big MMO cast.
No, we won't. Yes. Gets the question.
So Carl is pushing us to move on with the question because we have so many people lined up to call in. So Miguel, did you have something you wanted to ask?
I did. After listening to you guys, I know you, Johnny, and James as well, you guys are big JRPG fans. Mm. And I know that your show obviously geared towards Nintendo. I mean, that's the content you normally have lined up. But the question I had for you guys is, what RPGs, you know, JRPGs do you guys love that aren't on Nintendo platforms?
So it's been kind of a rough generation in general for that particular. I mean, the PSP's had a bunch of them, but they're all like the super niche variety.
Yeah.
Like if you can,
there are some
with
on PSP I'd like to play, and I don't have one, so I never. Yeah. Hopefully on Vita I can go back and play those.
Yeah. It's my understanding that the one that XC just put out, I'm trying to remember what it's called, is supposed to be really, really good. But
well, they did the Oath of Thal'Ghana. I mean, they've got those Wander or the Ease games, you know.
Yeah, but they put out one just recently. I can't remember what it's called, but it's supposed to be a really good game for the PSP.
Well, one that I can recommend very highly, I first played it on on Xbox Live as an indie game where I think I paid like $2 or $3 for it, but it's on Steam now, and apparently it's selling gangbusters on Steam. And it's called Cthulhu Saves the World. And you get it as a package with Breath of Death 7, but on Steam. I think you get two RPGs for like $3 or something. It's absurd. And they're Japanese-style RPGs. They're made in America, but they're Japanese-style. They're very old school. They look like NES games, basically. They're super retro, and they're really funny, and they're very well made. They kind of compress the, you know, a lot of the fluff, a lot of the stuff that's very time-consuming in Japanese RPGs, and they still have all that stuff. They just make it faster, and they're really, really fun to play. And that same company is making Penny Arcade Adventures Episode 3 in the same style.
I was going to say, are you setting me up?
I'm totally setting you up, dude. But only because I truly do love that game. I love Cthulhu Saves the World. It's fantastic.
Well, it's because of those games that we partnered with Zeboid Games, the developer, to revisit the Penny Arcade Adventures or Rainslick Precipice of Darkness games and continue with an episode 3. So it is going to be a very JRPG style of game.
That's kind of a change from the previous two titles, though, isn't it?
Yeah, the other two were kind of much more old Sierra Lucas adventure with a little bit of turn-based combat.
Yeah, I think this is going to be much more standard. Episode 1 and 2 of Penny Arcade Adventures, though, are also a good choice to answer your question, Miguel, because although they're not straight JRPGs, there are a lot of elements of JRPGs in them, including the sort of like interactive turn-based battle system like from Mario RPG. And those games are really, really fun, too. So you can get those on Xbox, PlayStation, PC. They're not hard to get. I think are they on iPad and stuff like that?
Not yet. I don't know for sure what the plans are there. But yeah, the Steam XBLA or Indie Channel XBLA.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to say was because the reason this all started was recently I just picked up a copy of Xenogears for the PS1. And I know that kind of ties in where you just said interactive battle system. If any of you guys have played Xenogears, you'll know that you have a combo system where you're pressing the face buttons and then you're doing like maybe let's say like triangles, kick and whatnot. And you're inputting these commands and then you're stringing along these combos. So I don't know if any of you guys have played Xenogears or whatnot.
James?
I played a little bit of it, but it's kind of a haze at this point.
There is sort of a heritage from Xenoblade, right?
Well, it's got some of the same people involved. It's not super.
Yeah, even the thing of they've said themselves, it's a bit tenuous to call.
Yeah, it's not really. They're not. They're related only through parentage.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I've heard about Xenogears for a long time. I'm a little bit scared to play it because I've heard it's incredibly long and confusing. Yeah. Like the story is very, very obtuse, let's say.
It's not super approachable, no.
I think it is available on the PSN store as a download.
Yeah,
I think I've thought about it, but I bought Vagrant Story like six months ago because everyone said that game is amazing and I always wanted to play it. I still haven't turned it on.
Yes,
I don't have enough time to play all my games, so I should probably wait on Xenogears.
I don't know that problem at all, Johnny.
There we go. Yeah, so the PSN actually is a good source of old PlayStation-era RPGs, which might be one of the halcyon days of that particular genre. But if you want to get something more recent, the game I was thinking of earlier was Trails of the Sky, which is supposed to be really good. But there's a PSP/Xbox Live arcade game that I languished love on, which also condenses all the conventions down into is Half Minute Hero, which I, on a previous episode, sat there and described in possibly sacred terms.
I don't like it as much as James, but I think it's really cool and you should check it out. So Miguel, we're going to have to let you go and move on to the next person, but thanks so much for calling.
Yeah. Thank you. I wish you guys, much success. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much.
James.
While he's transitioning, I'll say that if you want something more full featured, there's two Tales games on the next gen systems at this point now too.
Also check out Folklore on PS3 is also pretty cool. It's pretty much a forgotten RPG at this point.
And what was the one you really liked?
We talked about that once on the show.
Folklore, yep.
And Johnny, what was the one you really liked on the PS3?
By the way, TYP says in the chat that he hated Folklore.
Really? I thought it was pretty cool.
I said he talked about it.
He did talk about it, yes. Okay, so we've got Jesse on the line.
Greetings.
Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, Jesse.
Good. It's nice to be here with everyone.
Good to have you. Great to have you. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Kansas. And I met a number of you at E3, you know, either in the press room or in the roundtable meeting with Nintendo after the shows.
Oh, okay, cool.
Oh, wow. I need to put a face to your name now. I bet I would remember your face. That's great. So, Jesse, did you have anything you wanted to ask us?
Yes, I did. While I was at E3, I saw the big Wii U announcement. I had nice second row seats for that. It was awesome.
Oh, that's better than we had.
we were there at 6 in the morning waiting in line. Me and my crew were the first ones there.
Nice.
And who was your crew?
VG Tribune.
Okay, cool. Great. Oh, nice. Yeah, I know your name. I know that site.
Yeah, and actually, Neil was a co-host on our last podcast we recorded last week, and I finally got pushed out Thursday, and, you know, Greg, I feel your pain about editing. Anyway, so my question, when I saw the Wii U announcement, I had this mental image in my head of what I would pay for it. This price point I'd be okay with, mm-hmm. Knowing how much I paid for the 3DS just a few months back. Then 3DS price cut happened, and then now that mental image of the price in my head changed.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Did you all have a price point in your head at E3 and now, and how does it differ? Of what you want to pay for Wii U?
I guess my feeling hasn't changed that much based on the 3DS price drop, except I think it's pretty clear that $250 is the absolute maximum they would sell this thing for, and I wouldn't be shocked if they went to $200 because they are going for that. They're going to try to recapture the success of Wii in terms of getting the mass market. They're going to try to make it affordable. And obviously Wii was $250. It came with a game. So maybe that's the way they would do it. They would package it with a really compelling game and, you know, this big controller. But I think the difficulty for Nintendo is that they have shown and they've said explicitly that they want the Wii U to sort of recapture the sort of core gamer market. You know, they want to get some of the people who currently play a lot of Xbox and PlayStation. The problem for that is that the Wii U basically is an Xbox or a PlayStation under the hood. Now, it's probably a little more powerful than either one of those systems, but it's not really the next generation in terms of processing or graphics. So the problem is the Wii U is not competing, certainly for the first year, it's not going to be competing with PlayStation 4 or Xbox 720. Whatever those things are called. Right. Maybe down the line, we will consider it to be a competitor with those. For the first year, it's competing with the current PS3 and 360. And I think the problem for them in terms of pricing is that when you see it's going to have some of the same games and the graphics are going to be pretty much the same, maybe slightly better in some cases, and it'll have some tablet stuff, but that's not necessarily a selling point, right? For people who play, you know, especially when the games are identical across the other platforms. So I think they're going to have a hard time pricing this above, very much above what the current systems are at. And you can buy a 360 for $200 and probably less than that by the time Wii U comes out, probably $150. So that is going to make it hard for them to price Wii U far above where the current consoles are.
Yeah, I mean, they'll have to price it such that, you know, you could see somebody who owns, you know, a PS3 or something saying, okay, I will buy that as kind of my backup console sort of thing. Maybe they don't have a Wii, but they still like Nintendo games, you know, a couple of the big franchises. They'll have to keep that price down.
So I've discussed my mental calculus on the show for buying a console, which is
six games?
It's the value of the games. And I won't buy games above 50. That's the ceiling on the value. The value of the games has to exceed the price of the console by, I think it's 20%. So
is that the value of the games that you want to buy for it?
Yeah, that I want to buy for it and it alone. Essentially, I don't have something that I can play them on already. So once it's whatever the price of the console, usually plus one game, plus two games, then I say okay. I want to buy that console. That's the reason I haven't bought a PS3, because right now I'm still sitting at $150. Mm-hmm. And the PS3 hasn't come down to that point yet. So it's kind of this weird scenario for me.
Wait a minute. You guys are in the gaming industry. It's a non-reimbursed business expense. You can claim that stuff on your taxes.
Damn it.
Jeff, it's all non-reimbursed business expenses.
No, I didn't think of that. That's interesting.
I mean, for me, the interesting point with the 3DS more broadly, I don't know how much it changes how I would look at it necessarily. But the point is that Nintendo crossed a line there in terms of they show they are willing to drop the price if, you know, circumstances call for it. So that might change how people look at it now. Not so much from the point of view, well, the 3DS costs this many, you know, dollars, so how many dollars more is a Wii U worth? But it's like, right. Well, do I need to get it now? It might drop in price, you know, especially if it's a little higher. So I think, you know, some of it is going to be a question of what games they've got at launch. It's really good, you know, just go to James' kind of calculus. I think a lot of people have got a similar thing. What are Nintendo offering at launch? That is going to be the problem. Now, I could see them, given exchange rate and inflation, all that kind of stuff, in the US, maybe going to $299 if there's a pack in there. So if you could justify saying, well, you've got the big fancy controller and a game and the system for $300.
Like Catch Me?
Sure. Yeah, probably not. I mean, it would probably have to be a collection of those sorts of games at least.
But games like that one.
Yeah, maybe some sort of compendium of those sorts of games, you know, that show off what the console's capable of, you know, the Wii Sports kind of playbook. That I could say, that would be the ceiling. $299. It's got it at $300, but you've got add value, quote unquote, because of a packet.
Yeah, I mean $300 with a game, I could see that.
Yeah, $300 but, with the like game I with said, the controller is where I was having it in my head.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
That, like I said, that though, how willing people are going to be to pay for that, I think. Obviously, yeah, the packet has got to, you know, demonstrate some sort of value. For one of the areas where 3DS are short is I don't think many people have that much value at all to the AR stuff that were put in there. I mean, you know, maybe people fooled around with it once they had the system always kind of neat and showed it to other people. And other people in it, I think it did a lot for them in terms of justifying the $250. Whether the packing is going to deliver, because people think it could $50 or something.
Okay, you know. Greg, you're cutting out a little bit for us, so why don't we pivot here, and we're gonna have to get a new person here in a sec. But one thing I wanted to mention, Jesse, this is a great question you brought up, and I'm surprised we haven't really talked about this a whole lot before. I'm sure it'll be a big issue next year, though.
Well,
but one of the really interesting things to me about Nintendo's pricing strategy for this new console is if you look ahead to the competing consoles when they come out probably a year later in 2013, Microsoft and Sony are both going to be looking for ways to launch their consoles at lower prices than they did last generation. Because if you remember the start of last generation, both of those systems got off to really slow starts. It's part of the reason Nintendo was so successful. But their consoles were priced out of the market. I mean, Sony launched PS3 at $500 and $600. They cannot do that again, and they won't. So, number one, that means that they're going to be launching consoles at closer to the price of Nintendo, so there'll be a little bit closer competition this time in terms of pricing. Number two, it also means that Sony and Microsoft probably aren't going to be making crazy technology jumps like they did last time, because they know that they can't make up that difference in the price. So it also means that, you know, even though Wii U is not going to be a huge leap over the current generation in terms of technology, the other consoles may not be a huge leap over Wii U. So it's going to get real murky in terms of what the new generation is capable of doing and where things are pricing at. I think it's going to be a really interesting competition next generation.
Yeah, I think it's going to be hinged less on hardware and more on services.
Yeah.
All right. Or just software. Yeah. I mean,
we've already got the consoles matching the highest resolution of the highest resolution TVs. You can't get higher than that until the TV technology bumps up.
Well, it won't be a resolution raise, but there are other ways in which the quality will go up. So, Jesse, thank you very much. We're going to have to let you go and get the next person on.
All right. Enjoy. I enjoyed it, and have fun with your many hours left.
Thank you.
I hope it is many hours.
Let's see how many are left. Let's do it.
All right. So the next person is Nathan.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Nathan.
So I'm calling from Los Angeles, California.
Oh, hey, nice. Hey.
And I really loved your site. I remember back
when it was Planet GameCube, and you're actually the reason I have anything to do with podcast. I got my Android phone, my G1, and got Beyond Pod, and had a hell of a commute to work. And so Mondays, Tuesdays, depending on how long the podcast is, you guys keep me from just driving over the center divider on the 5 for traffic.
Well, I'm glad to be of service. Oh, man. Well, that's great, Nathan. So did you have a question for us?
Yeah, so I don't know if I blanked out, but I didn't realize the last retroactive was River City Ransom. And that game came out just before I turned 10, and it was really something special. I have no idea how I talked my mom into getting it. It's sort of a slightly violent game. But
yeah,
the just the idea that you're walking through a town and visiting different cities, and the cities, the malls are alive and have different different stores, and you go in them. Just that idea of an open world just really blew my mind as a kid. I really, it was just something, it blew my mind. It was something like I'd never seen before. So I loved playing an open world like that. I felt like it was alive and real. That's what it impressed me when I was 10. My question is, are there any other open world games from around that era, things that just seemed like they kind of existed before you put the game in the system and kind of existed after you played? Anything that you enjoyed?
So to an extent, I would say the first Zelda game, just because it was not quite in the same way, but more because it was the openest game I had encountered at that point. Keeping in mind that I actually played the game later because I was, let's just say, not very old when it came out. But I mean, it was this game with a big world. You had to move around in all directions to get to where you wanted to go. But in a way, like River City Ransom, where there's, it's a populated world with people in it, and there are stores and places to go that you can twist and turn around. I can't think of anything. But then again, like I said, I was not very old when that game came out either. If anybody wants to make a guess.
Yeah, John, I mean, there were a lot of games at that time.
Didn't it come out the year you were born?
Possibly. 86.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of games around that time. That's the thing. I mean, a lot of games around that time were very kind of like A to B sort of games. Like
arcade, really, it was all about arcade-style design. That's the thing. As we talked about on the retroactive, that's what I think makes River City Ransom really quite special. And I can't put myself in Nathan's position there. But yeah, I can imagine how it would have been impactful.
Yeah, I mean, even games that that had a map that you moved around on were typically just kind of like you were almost like moving a chess piece on the map, and then you went into just a normal straight A to B sort of playing.
Yeah, area. There was a divide between an open world and the town, so it's relatively sort of continuous.
Didn't Pac-Samadu have a little bit of
A bit, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember being overwhelmed by Pac-Samadu.
The tree, yes.
I played it when it came out on the virtual Japanese virtual console. It was quite overwhelming for various reasons. But yeah, I mean, the thing about Pac-Samadu is that it's got the consistency that's quite uncommon. You know, it's not like like the fire world and the eye and all that kind of stuff. It's all themed around the tree. Obviously, it's a very different game. But that kind of consistency gives more of a sense of being in a cohesive world. There's maybe the sense of forget more common, because you usually had to kind of the graphics were the same for technical limitations, or they did really try to differentiate them with like completely different color palettes.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Greg, we're having trouble hearing you again, so why don't you hang up and then reconnect? That might help a little bit.
All right. Well, all right. Yeah.
So I stepped out for a sec. Did anyone mention Zelda, the original?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. That's the first
Metroid,
thing that came
Metroid,
to
you
mind.
Could, yeah, Metroid, you could even say that was one of the first kind of open world games, in the sense that, you know, you could go anywhere you wanted as long as you opened up the different areas and there was a lot of backtracking. Mm-hmm. It's kind of one of the hallmarks.
It's similar
to
Zelda in that way. I think the first Zelda and the first Metroid have a lot in common, and they sort of diverged after that. But those games are very similar, just from a different perspective, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you could suggest in the chat that I don't know what to call it.
Oh yeah, Scheherazade. I've never played that game. I've heard a lot about it, and the music's very cool. He played it on Radio Trivia once.
Yeah.
Anyone here played Scheherazade?
I never have.
No.
Never played it.
I remember doing gameplay calls on that game. That was whenever they would mention that game, I'd cringe. That and God, there was another one. Something where you had to look for the crowns. Legacy of the Crown. Or something.
Oh, Legacy of the Wizard.
Oh, there was somewhere you had to find like the mom's crown and the dad's crown, and
yes.
Directions were horrible. And if anyone would call with those games, those two games, I just wanted to hang up on them.
Yeah. Oh, I missed the 900 helplines. That's fantastic.
Legacy of the Wizard is related to the Monster Boy series, I think. Maybe it's related to the Xanadu series. I mean, it's related to some famous like Japanese franchise that spanned many, many games, but when they brought it to the West, they changed the name totally. And anyway, it's kind of confusing. It's a very interesting game for sure. If you ever find a copy, you should check it out. But yeah, that is kind of very, it's very
Legacy of the West. That's it. By Broderbund.
Yeah. Well, they
in
the West. So yeah, all right. So Greg is back. Hey,
is it sounding better? You'll have to tell me.
Interesting note here. Quintet was involved in that game as well.
Mm, yeah. So all right, good question. So Nathan, I think we have the next person coming up, so we'll have to say goodbye to you.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for everything you're doing. I love this telethon and. I just want to say that I'm waiting for Wii U. I have the best game idea ever.
Yeah? What is it?
Gold Rush 1849 panning for gold. It'll be a system seller.
That could actually be pretty clever.
Hey, you know, maybe you can make it a Wii U wear game.
You know, there I you can go. See that being
Don't
a
use
game.
That phrase.
Game. Like
Don't
some
use
sort of
that
mini
phrase
game.
Ever.
That'd be cool.
So write all the royalty checks to me. I can. Ready and waiting.
All right. Thanks
guys.
Man.
Thanks.
Okay, so we have Sarek on the line.
Hello, everybody.
Hi. Hey, did I say that right, Sarek?
Yeah, C-E-R-I-C, Sarek. You can just call me Steve, my actual name. I'd like to come on. I've been trying for since a long time.
Yeah.
I'm sure everybody in the forum wants to kill me by now, but hey.
Congrats.
Where are you calling from, sir?
I'm there with Krim. Anyway, just decided to ask about what do you guys think about the current marketing? It seems a little confusing at the current time what they're really going for, like the Mario Kart cards at the LA Auto Show being their big secret with all their things, and then we got shields falling on our heads for Legend of Zelda and stuff.
Yeah.
It's sort of
that
like it's
kind of strange. Well, I mentioned this on the last RFN episode, but I think the Mario 3D Land commercial where the guy is sort of inside the game and it's showing it from all the different angles that you play the game from, I think it's really effective in showing just the 3D construction of the worlds and the way that you turn and you go around things and you jump over things, you know, and it really gives you a sense that it's very much like old school Mario, but the worlds are now in 3D, whereas, you know, Mario 64 is more of it creates a world that you kind of wander around. This is more like it's old 3D Mario, it's old Mario games, but now they're in 3D and you kind of have to do the same things, but you have to think in a different dimension. It's really effective.
Yep.
I guess the big thing is where you get these sort of some of these weird, you know, things that might strike you as weird is because they've dropped the old standardized approach that seemed to work well for them in the early days of the Wii. You know, we would like to play in the States and all that, you know, so that you're probably going to get a few more kind of things, a bit more wacky, a bit more out there, maybe it's a bit more hit or miss, but you know, the standardized approach has its limitations too for selling certain kinds of games, especially ones that might be a bit more sort of out of the typical realm.
Yeah, it doesn't really work for something like a Metroid game where
certainly not.
You've got this family sitting around in this all white furnitured room, like it's 1980s.
Like going to an airport.
Yeah, the airport thing was just that's
like
a punching bag.
Nintendo marketing of all time, isn't it?
Well, we might have a few things to talk about in the GameCube segment. For my part.
Yeah,
you know,
cubes.
Present company might have some interesting conversation on that if he's allowed to say anything.
Yeah, Jeff, can you comment on Nintendo marketing? Your thoughts?
I'm in an awkward position now because at Penny Arcade I sell advertising on the website, so I don't want to. That should be their new marketing. Is put more ads up on Penny Arcade. I remember being there when they made the drastic switch to Play It Loud and trying to get all edgy. I think part of the problem is most marketers in general are not the people that need to be marketed to. When you have gamers that are in charge of marketing, that's when you end up with the really good campaigns. Mm-hmm. But 99% of the time, you're going through these big agencies that, they're selling cars one minute, and then they're selling hot dogs, and then they're selling games, and they don't understand who they're marketing to.
Or they're selling Bigfoot pizzas.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, they market out of a textbook.
So the companies that are either doing it in-house or they've got people that's when you tend to see the campaigns that really click, because they go, what would I like to see? How would I like to see this communicated to me, instead of going by, every advertising school book course? What's our target demographic? Well, they like excitement and loud music. Let's
exactly.
For me, actually, from about the same general time frame, the ad that I always remember is the I think it was the Golden Sun 2 ad, the Symphony ad, because that ad was so over the top and ridiculous, but it actually did kind of weirdly tie in that this is a handheld RPG, and it actually featured elements of the game design in and of itself. So for me, that ad was awesome because I'd never seen anything like it. But
wasn't there, for the original Golden Sun on GBA, wasn't there an ad where a kid was playing it in church?
There might have been. Oh, no, that's the same ad. I think he was playing it at a symphony, though, because they started using –
I thought it was
like
a church for some reason.
Yeah, they had a sequence of specifically Game Boy Advance games where the person would be playing it, and then the world would change around them to reflect.
Yes.
I mean, I remember a Donkey Kong one where they were in the car. I think it was Donkey Kong. And there was because I remember working on one when we did Final Fantasy Dawn of Souls, which was Final Fantasy 1 kind of re-imaged, repackaged, where we had it was big, expensive CG dragon flying out from between the buildings while the kid was playing. And I think those are effective when you're – it's funny how hard it is to get marketing people to actually incorporate elements of the game into the marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I remember I was going to mention that game in particular because I remember the chandelier turned into a dragon from the actual game itself, which was
kind of cool. Yeah. So a couple notes. First off, we just crossed $1,900. So thank you, everyone very much. We are getting really close now to unlocking the GameCube thing, and that is that's a must-do, in my opinion. We have to do that. It's going to be fantastic. I wanted to mention that Sarek is apparently a popular hero among the chat room because everyone was cheering for him when he got on. So, Sarek, before we let you go, I wanted to quickly ask if you had a favorite Nintendo commercial or Nintendo ad that really sort of stood out to you and you thought was really effective.
Honestly, I really like the Playing with Power series, but that might just be because I was young and Nintendo Power still had comics in it. But that one really resonated with me just in general, that idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's that one's stuck around kind of thing. Like I still say it. Yep, now I'm playing with power, super power.
Yes, you do.
It was just
do.
I'll say it out at the clubs.
I remember I had a friend when I was young, and he really loved the one. He would quote. I mean, he would just say this over and over again. But it was back in the Genesis versus Super Nintendo wars, and Genesis had a slogan of like, "Take your gaming to the next level." And then when Star Fox came out, Nintendo put out an ad that said, "Why go to the next level when you can go light years beyond?" Great, it's great stuff.
Genesis does what Nintendo don't.
Yep, that's a classic. That's, too.
Those are the days.
The big two-page ad, Altered Beast over on it. Yep, I remember.
Stop. Don't mention Altered Beast in my presence.
All right.
Sarek, thanks very much for your call.
Thanks, bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Was that his cat?
It was.
Sounded like a cat in the background. Just.
It's the cat cast.
It's apparently very hungry.
Okay, so the next person should be coming on any second. Hopefully. Hello?
It's ringing. Ringing.
Oh, okay. Still ringing.
Slowly ringing. Come on.
It's all good. This there might be our last caller, but it depends on how things go. So we'll have to see. We don't want to eat into the game of the year discussion.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hey.
Who is this, Shannon?
Yes, this is Shannon.
Hi, Shannon. Where are you calling from?
Covington, Tennessee.
Oh, hey. Nice. Very nice. Yep, but you're out near Stan Ferguson, not too far away. Is that near Manchester?
I'm sorry?
Is that near Manchester?
Not that I know of. Oh, okay. I've only lived here for about 2 or 3 years, so.
Oh, okay.
Come on, Mets. Making the guests uncomfortable.
Oh, it's awkward.
It's awkward anyway. So, Shannon, did you have a question for us?
I actually kind of had two. First of all, have y'all played any of the Persona games?
James?
I have not.
I don't believe so. No. No, I have not.
I came really close at one point to trying Persona 3 Fez when that came out because it was kind of a budget game and it seemed like there was a lot to do. And I know a lot of people really like it, but I never did get around to it. And then right after that, they put out 4 and I was like, oh, well, now if I'm going to play it, I guess I would play 4. But I haven't had the time because those are games kind of like Xenoblade and, you know, some of these other ones where people always talk about how it takes like 100 hours to beat it.
See, I think instead of Desert Bus, we need Johnny next year to sit down and play all the Personas as a live stream straight.
Well, Giant Bomb pretty much did that as an endurance run. They played through Persona 4 and it took them months to get through it. So they played like an hour a day and they videoed the whole thing.
Jeez.
I think they all considered that to be kind of a mistake.
Once you're in, you can never get out.
Yeah. Shannon, have you played them? I mean, are you a fan?
I've been playing Persona 3 Fez for about the last 2 months and just kind of on and off. And I'm really surprised I completely missed this when it first came out because I really enjoy a lot of the JRPGs and this one is by far pushing a lot of them back in my list of favorites.
Really? Hmm. So you're loving it, huh?
Yeah, I'm about 40 hours into it, and I'm as far as what I've read, I'm not even halfway done with it yet.
Oh, God, that's terrifying.
Oh, so it's a 2-week game is what you're telling me.
2 weeks for you, but some of us have jobs.
Yeah. That's the scary part. I do.
James actually works a lot. He just doesn't sleep. That's where James's time comes from. He just doesn't sleep very much.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Shannon, what was your other question?
Why is the PlayStation 2 still alive and kicking?
Is it?
It still is in Japan.
I saw an annualized game. I don't remember what series it was that had a PS2 version recently.
I was at Walmart last night, and I saw they still had PlayStation 2 systems. They had Madden 2K, they had Madden 12, they had NBA 2K12, and they had the WWE
All-Stars.
There's a PS2
NBA game. There's not an actual NBA. Perfect.
Yeah.
There's like 100 million of these things out there. I mean, it just sold so wide. I mean, basically, if you release a game for it, there's still people out there who that's the system they own.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. I mean, it's people that probably bought a PS2 but never moved on from it. And because it kind of won that particular round of the console wars, so many people out there have it. That's what they have. It's like, you know, like a friend of mine still has a GameCube. So he's like still out there playing like, you know, Metroid Prime 2, you know? But that's like where, you know.
It's still the keys.
Yeah.
So then I guess the question then, you know, as a follow-up is then, since Wii won this generation, is Wii still going to be around in, let's say, 2016?
Mm.
Wow. I mean, are they still going to be releasing new Wii games?
They might still be releasing Just Dance version whatever on it. I
believe it. I really do. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because, you know, the thing is, I don't think that third parties have bailed completely. Obviously, third parties haven't bailed completely on the PS2, but I think on the Wii, might be a little bit different.
Well,
there's
still what I call the bin games coming out for the Wii in huge numbers. And, you know, a lot of what came out for the PS2 late in its life were the bin games. I wouldn't be surprised to see for those games to continue to come out because ultimately if you want to buy something besides said games of the bin, you have to actually make them for those systems. And A, their systems won't have a wide net, and B, it'll be more expensive to develop for them than it will be. I mean, yeah. Their goal is to make is to sell just enough copies that their low overhead turns a profit.
Yeah. Also, you know, you're still seeing sports games being made, which is key because they can just use the same engine and just drop in new players, new rosters.
By the way, how depressing is it if you're the team that's making the PS2 Madden right now? Are you like the M team? I mean, how many letters down the alphabet do you have to go?
Maybe it's like a school project for some elementary school.
Just changing the names on the rosters, you mean?
Yeah, like my first coding project, you know?
Search and replace.
Yeah, uh-huh. I mean, that's got to be a strange life to know that if someone says, hey, oh, what do you do for a living? Oh, I make video games. Wow, that's really cool. What do you make?
Madden.
I make PlayStation 2 games in 2011.
You would just say, I make Madden, and they'd be like, oh, that's great, man. And then you might mumble yourself on the PS2.
Actually, I wonder if it's just like one person who sort of does that.
He just changes the text Donovan McNabb to Kevin Kolb to Michael Vick. That's all he does.
Yeah. I mean, that's the
why
thing.
Why is Vick so slow? I don't get it.
I think that's why you still see these games around for the PS2 is because they're probably very cheap to make, like sports games in particular.
Yeah, exactly. They've already been made. You are just updating them. And then, yep, you know, yeah. There's a certain amount of audience out there that might still use them. But I suppose the most curious thing is that, you know, they're still selling a few systems. But, you know, when this, you know, now with the Wii down to 99 or whatever it is, like that's kind of funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do wonder how many systems they actually sell. I don't know that it still gets listed. I mean, we don't.
I would say I would imagine they must. They probably sell some in more emerging markets, right? I mean,
oh yeah, globally. So you previous generation consoles are actually still expensive in a lot of BRIC countries.
And like, you know, I mean, a Master System had a very disturbingly long life,
yes,
in like South,
oh, like
America.
In South America.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's weird stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, I see maybe the PS2 is still, if it's still a going, yes, concern in some country, they still make the hardware, then they can still maybe, you know, sell a few in the markets that are, you know, the mature markets even.
Well, I mean, in Japan, I mean, in the last couple of weeks, just to give you an example, these are the charts for October 31st to November 6th. The PS2 outsold both the DSi and the DS Lite.
Wow.
In Japan.
So yep. I wonder if that's if it's related to the lack of backwards compatibility in PS3, most PS3 systems.
Maybe to an extent.
And because people have so many PS2 games that they love, you know, from 6 or 7 years ago probably. They, you know, PS2s are also known for breaking. I've had
a lot
of
the early ones,
you know,
were. Yeah.
So I wonder if it's a case of people, you know, they go back to play their old PS2 games and they find out that the system doesn't work very well anymore. So they go out and buy a brand new one because they figure, well, this one will last me another 10 years, right? So they kind of go out and buy, they sort of future-proof themselves to make sure that they always have a PS2 because they're not confident that the next system will play PS2 games.
Mm. Yep.
I could be as well. So just people buying placements.
It's like someone preparing for the end of the world. They've got their bunker, and instead of canned food, it's just a bunch of PS2s lined up on the shelf.
Right. Oh, man. That's going to get a letter.
Yeah.
See, and that's pretty sad considering my Super Nintendo still works and PlayStation 2s are crashing.
Yeah, well,
yellow?
Super Nintendo has no moving parts.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, you know, your PS2 will die at some point because the CD drive will go. Something in there will go.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think Sony's learned that lesson with Vita, because PSP had this big, you know, disk drive in it, and number one, it sucked up a lot of power. Number two, it broke. Number three, it caused giant loading times. Number four, it made a lot of noise. You know, people hated that thing. So with Vita, there's just not one, you know, and I think there's a very strong case for that. I never bought an iPod until they came out with a flash memory version, because I didn't want this hard drive spinning in a device that's in my pocket that I'm going to drop all the time.
Yep.
That makes a big difference in the longevity of products. It really does. Moving parts are bad. If you can avoid them, do it.
Speaking of moving parts.
Yeah, it's time to move on to the next segment. That's a fantastic segue.
Thank you all for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you for calling and listening, Shannon.
All right, I'll let you guys get to your game of – is that next up, game of the year?
Yes. Game of the year. And that's Nintendo game of the year.
It may not even be out yet.
Don't even talk Skyrim and all that stuff. So, Jeff Callis, thank you very much for being here. We will hopefully talk to you a little bit later.
Yeah, I'll check back in and see if we've made it to our goal and pocket some stories for hopefully we will.
Oh man, I hope so. I'm pretty confident.
All right. All right. Take care, guys, and thanks so much for doing this for Child's Play. You know, we really appreciate it. And what makes Child's Play so great, I think, is the way the community is kind of adapted it as their cause, and so many activities go to support it that we have no part in, which it means it's grown bigger than us, which I think is a testament to how wonderful an organization it is.
It is great. It's a fantastic charity. So thank you guys for making something that inspires us to do something about it. You know, that's a big deal. So thanks again, Jeff.
All right, have fun. Later. All right. Take care. Bye.
All right. Now we're going to make a transition to the next segment. We're going to have a lot of new voices on. I get to take a break. Greg gets to take a break.
So, like, I'm off. I'm dropping off, right?
Yep. Yep. So we're going to have a totally new set of people in here, and they're going to talk about the Nintendo Game of the Year. And they're not going to choose a winner. They're just going to have a discussion, but they'll tell you all about it. So hang on the line, hang on the stream, and we'll be back in just a sec.
You haven't even played it, Lindemann.
Oh, I will be tomorrow.
And that's going to do it for part one of the live telethon. Come back for part two when Neil, Zach, Don, and Scott discuss their games of the year. TYP and Greg host Radio Trivia Live, and finally, when Johnny and Greg go over the memoirs of the GameCube with Penny Arcade's Jeff Callis, the Totally Rad Show's Jeff Cannata, Planet GameCube's own founder Billy Berghammer, and our old friend, the one and only Rick Powers. We'll be right back.